Who's going to run the country now? Tell me that.
It's all right. Don't worry. That lot.
Good evening, and tonight in Nationwide we're looking at a political situation that's entirely new to Great Britain. For the first time in our history, we find ourselves the subject of a puppet government, and in the studio tonight to answer questions on some of the topics raised by this situation, we have the Prime Minister. Good evening, Prime Minister. Some of your critics might perhaps suggest that the responsibility of running the country may be outside your previous political experience. What, your critics? Oh, yes, I see. Well, at this stage, perhaps we should bring in the newly appointed Home Secretary. Good evening, Home Secretary. Do say hello to the Prime Minister. Now, perhaps I could begin by raising a point which was made earlier. I'm sorry, what was that, Prime Minister? You want to play your xylophone? No, please, you must... Stop it, Home Secretary. Prime Minister.
This is Bristol. It's 3 minutes past seven. No, it's 3 minutes past five. Actually, I don't know if anyone heard it. During the week, we had one of the BBC newsreaders at 7 p.m. say, "This is the BBC at 11 o'clock. And I'm thinking, no, it's not. It's 7 o'clock. And he quickly corrected himself. So I'm correcting myself too. No, it's 5 past 5 or 4 minutes past five. And welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. On the 31st of May 2024, it's Bilderberg weekend, one of the craziest weekends in the annual show catalogue, and we'll be hoping to be going live to Madrid at 7 o'clock where the Bilderbergers are convening, trying to get their war with Russia started, or their pretend war with Russia started, or whatever it is they're playing around at streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokescroft Arts Centre in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, also on DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores. Aurora app, please, not Google Play. So, I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military propaganda psyops, the puff pieces on the conspirators and the hatchet jobs on the heroes. Like Diane Abbott, McCarthyite witch hunts going on after anyone with influence who speaks up for humanity and against the World War III wage slavery lies. So for those with eyes to see and ears to hear, these so-called solutions to every crisis, whether it's Gaza, Ukraine, COVID, migrants, farming, cost of living, climate, twisted accelerationist Armageddonist policies designed to make every crisis worse, in case you hadn't noticed, and the politicians have nothing to say. Nick Land's behaviourist dark enlightenment drones, the cowards and control freaks want us slaves to their machines, much easier to control, aren't they? Meanwhile, pantheous wife murdering WEF king tampon Charlie wages war on the British people, as well as China, Russia and the BRICS, with regime change maniac sidekick Diddy David Cameron. In fact, now Charlie's in charge, isn't he? We don't have any MPs anymore. So King Charles, anything that happens, it's all on his watch. Helping us navigate the World Economic Forum's fourth industrial revolution, the fourth Reich matrix, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. And also joining me in the studio is investigative journalist Wesley Baer. So in part one this week, we'll be looking particularly at this Diane Abbott climb down by Starmer. Today we hear she will be allowed to stand as a Labour candidate. And the problem with Diane is she's a leadership threat to Keir Starmer. Oh dear, what would happen if anything happened to Starmer? She might actually take over, being a bit of a Corbynista. So they're very, very worried about her. We'll also be looking at the Nigel Farage, him saying that Labour have already won the general election, hearing Peter Mandelson's fears that he inadvertently caused Rishi Sunak to call a snap general election. Well, how about that for the ego of one of Jeffrey Epstein's mates? And in part two, we'll be hearing from Duncan Campbell, exclusive interview with him. He's an investigative journalist back in the 1980s, as part of the ABC trial, some of our older listeners will know, and he talks about that in the longer interview. But he's extremely concerned about what's going on with the Ukrainians, supposedly, with a lot of help from NATO, taking out these Russian ballistic missile early warning defence radar. The Russians, as many of us are saying, but except the mainstream press, is, well, maybe the Russians are sitting there thinking it's time to take out some of NATO's early warning defence radars. So let's just start, though, with a chat with Wesley here, sitting with me in the studio. Now, Wesley, you have been here in the past because you're working for this group called Acorn the Union. But here, one of the things you've been doing, even before you joined them, was looking into local police, wasn't it?
That's right, yeah. So not just specifically local police, but kind of any public service, really. So it kind of focused mainly around the police, because essentially when I'm out, you know, making stories or recording, the police are generally called on myself. So
really? Where?
Well, it happens a lot.
What sort of incident?
So, I mean, I like to call them my casual compliance checks. So essentially, I'll go to a public service. I would have made sure that I got myself up to date with their policy, their procedures and stuff like that. And I will literally go there and film for a time until, you know, I've watched them through their kind of little routine.
So give us an example, though. Whereabouts might you turn up? Outside the housing office or what?
Yeah, I've been to housing offices. I've been to Royal Mail sorting offices. I've been to Tesco head office and asked why they aren't reimbursing members of the public for the amount of money they made during the pandemic. I've been to police stations, GCHQ. I've been all over the country, actually.
So. Amazing. Well, so do you want to take us through, explain how you first got inspired to start doing this?
Yeah, so it was during lockdown. I came across some American First Amendment auditors was the first experience I had of it. I then witnessed a video of a lady who was out exercising during the lockdown. She was sat on a bench enjoying a sunset, exercising her mind, trying to kind of negate her mental health going down. And she was arrested by the police. And that kind of, coupled with me watching the other American auditors, made me think, you know, perhaps there should be more people in this country.
Okay, so auditors, this word is actually quite important, isn't it? This is the idea is that this is a sort of citizen audit.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely, yeah. So I wouldn't be able to tell you where the first coined the term auditor for kind of like what we do. But yeah, essentially we audit public services, which is kind of the crux.
Now, you know, what you first sparked off in my mind is the incredible, I think I was over in New Zealand at the time, stuck over there, but seeing the, I think it was the North Yorkshire or the Yorkshire police anyway, telling people that they weren't allowed to go for a walk on the moor because they might be spreading COVID. This is around about May, June 2020. Mm-hmm. Now, this incident with the lady sitting on a bench, I mean, isn't the idea, I mean, say, for example, in China, the people were being completely locked in. They weren't even allowed to come out of their homes, were they?
No, it's absolutely crazy. And that was one of the big things for many of the police auditors around, you know, the very fact that, you know, we're not living in a country where, you know, we are told to go where we have to and, you know, follow rules blindly. You know, should we need to go out and exercise our mind and enjoy some sunshine or a beautiful sunset or a beautiful sunrise? You know, we believe we should be able to. So the very fact that the police over in this country were kind of, you know, almost military at times when it came to COVID was...
Well, I can remember when they had something on the local TV news here with the Welsh police hiding behind a rock on the border between England and Wales. I think it was Gloucestershire, somewhere like that. And as someone in a car comes past, the police pounce. And I looked at this and I thought, really? Really? So you got a whole load of cops like hiding in the hills. And of course, it wasn't happening at all, really. This was just designed as part of the kind of nudge unit to scare people, don't go to Wales. Mm. Well, of course, you know, people were going to Wales. I went to Wales and went for walks out in the middle of nowhere. Didn't really, I mean, I spoke to a couple of people. In fact, we had this rather funny incident where there was some, this is, you know, maybe you're during, you know, right the early days of COVID, where there was a couple walking towards us in the middle of the forest somewhere. and I crossed my hands over my chest. I said, "Stay back, stay back." And we all had a right laugh about it, because it's like, you know, this was sort of, there's an absurdity. There was an absurdity to it. And in a way, the auditors are going in there saying, "Hey, what are you doing?"
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, accountability is key all around. You know, the policing service in this country is there essentially to hold us accountable for our wrongs. But who's actually holding the police accountable? You know, you think about the IOPC, for example, who deal with police complaints, is all ex-police officers, you know? So is essentially they're policing themselves, and it's not working, which is why we have horrendous police officers like, you know, Wayne Cousins, just to name one. I mean, one in Bristol, in fact, I actually had an interaction with him whilst out doing a compliance check on Keynsham Police Station, a PC, Daniel Woolwork. He actually tried to run me over. And 3 weeks later, I saw all over the Evening Post that he'd actually been dismissed for taking a picture of a dead body and insinuating that he wanted to do things with it. So
there's a thing called professional standards within the police, mm-hmm. Which is supposed to look at all this from internal, but generally internal complaints, and some external complaints. But word on the street from the actual decent, honest police is that these people are some of the most corrupt in the police force. So when they have to be taken off of active duty, then they get put into the professional. Anyway, that let's just Martin, do you want to say something about this business? Because I know you were quite pro the lockdowns and the COVID measures, because seeing it as a sort of psychological lesser and more actually a real chemical biological weapons attack, but there are a lot of people, that particularly young people, that thought, well, it's not going to make any difference to me if I catch this, it might even be good for me.
Well, I mean, we obviously debated this fairly long at the time. My view on it is that there was a deliberate attack by the US deep state, initially on the Chinese, because they need to take the Chinese now before they become too strong. That's why it happened at Wuhan, it began in Wuhan just before the Chinese New Year. The Chinese then adopted what are essentially wartime measures. They didn't lock down. They locked down very hard to begin with, and then they released. They came out of lockdown first. Mm. And, of course, this has been confirmed by Kirillov, who's the head of the Russian chemical warfare troops, who said, "We've discovered these biological warfare facilities in Ukraine where they were, in fact, doing stuff with COVID." And, of course, by General Salami, who is the head of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, because he said, "We think this is a biological warfare attack."
I'm really talking more about the attitude of the police here, but I mean, I'm sure you're quite right. But I mean, the point is, if this really was a serious biological attack, there would have been billions of people killed.
No, because your biological warfare doesn't necessarily want, you don't want to kill everybody. You want to make it very, very difficult for their economy to function. And therefore, whatever steps you take, there's going to be costs. And in actual fact, if you look at the costs for loss of output per person and deaths, the Chinese did very, very well, and we did very, very badly. And of course, the most people who complain about all of the lockdowns, yeah, and all the rest of it fail to understand that Jeffrey Sachs, who used to be a very top economist in Russia when I was used to work over there, he was put in charge by the Lancet of finding out where the COVID came from. And he appointed Peter Daszak to go and look into it in Wuhan.
Yeah.
Daszak didn't bother to tell Sachs that in actual fact he had been funding gain-of-function research in, yeah, the Wuhan laboratory.
He'd been actually over there, hadn't he? Can we get back to the policing of it? Can we get back to the policing of it? Because Wesley is really focusing on the more extreme measures that the police were taking. For example, the policing of, you know, people going for a walk up in the moors.
Listen, Tony, it was probably lots of things were done wrong, but don't forget, you're dealing with warfare. And when there's going to be even more warfare. We'll probably discuss this later in the programme. But I think General Kirillov and General Salami, because, of course, the second outbreak after Wuhan was in Qom's in Iran, and it was a different variant from the one in Wuhan.
Yeah, well, we're talking about North Yorkshire, really, and about the police. Martin, we're talking about the police reaction here. Martin, will you please talk about the police reaction here rather than Iran or anywhere like that? That's what we're here to talk about. So please, will you just stick to that?
No, you. What you want?
No,
to do,
what, what no. We've got a guest in the studio. Can you just, Martin? We've got a guest who's come here into the studio to talk about the police here, not about Iran or anything like that. So I would like you to please have a bit of respect for Wesley and address the points that I'm making on his behalf.
Absolute respect for Wesley, but we've had this debate many's the time, and I think the fact is that you're simply unwilling to accept the reality behind all of this. It's not just because
I think you're unwilling to accept. I mean, the whole point of the lockdowns, Martin, the whole point of the lockdowns was to scare people so much that they would take a vaccine which might be very dangerous for them and make a lot of money for people like Bill Gates. So that was the point. That was actually the point of the lockdowns. The actual point of the lockdowns was to force people to be frightened enough to take a vaccine so that they could then start to come out of their homes and travel and that sort of thing. That's a very important part of it, which you haven't even mentioned there.
To discuss the vaccines as a method of, you know, basically...
Anyway, I think you've had your say, so we'll just cut... Can we just cut Martin off now, please, Dave? Dave, can you just cut Martin off? Because I want to give Wesley a chance to speak, and Martin's not really allowing that. He's taking this discussion off in his own direction, so thanks. So Wesley, do you want to just take us through some of the investigations that you did during lockdown and how you got on?
Yeah, one of the main ones I did was when there was lots of news coverage about the A&E departments in hospitals being ram-jam packed and nobody can go in. And I saw a couple of other citizen journalists, auditors, go and film in empty A&Es. They had their videos removed from YouTube. So I've got a little head camera. So I thought I'd put my head camera on.
So what, did you pretend to be ill yourself and go into A&E?
I absolutely did, yeah. And I purposely went in the bottom entrance of the BRI, you'll know it, so that I could walk through and then into A&E, and it was totally empty, Tony. There was maybe
we're talking about 2020, which month?
We're looking at around just before the end of the lockdown, so towards middle of May time.
Okay.
Yeah, so around that
the first time. Lockdown.
Yeah, the first one, that was probably the most significant finding I found.
The bizarre thing is that there were all these hospitals that had been set up. What were they called?
The Nightingale Hospitals,
which were supposed to take all this extra capacity. Mm-hmm. And what you're hinting to me is that actually there wasn't any need, there was no excess use of the capacity that was already there.
Yeah, no, there wasn't. I visited many, many, many Nightingale hospitals as well, as did many other auditors, and they essentially weren't hospitals. They were just kind of camps for people to get vaccinated or to be tested. You know, I didn't see a single, you know, hospital type thing there.
A lot of money was spent on these.
An absolute fortune was spent.
And now, did you get any hostility or questions
every time
when you went in, and how did you deal with those?
Oh, you could never actually get in, Tony. They kind of set cordons up around kind of like 50 to 100 meters away. Like, you couldn't actually
from
the Nightingale hospitals.
Okay,
yeah.
But what about the accident and emergency centers? You can surely walk in there.
Yeah, I got through there absolutely fine. I actually removed my video because two other people were prosecuted for video recording inside the hospital. So rather than kind of risk that myself, I thought I'd remove the video. But yeah, when it came to the Nightingale hospitals, there would be security stationed kind of like all over the place around. They tended to use unis and kind of car parks and stuff like that and set up a cordon, as I said. So you couldn't get within kind of 50 or 100 meters. You had to use Zooms, and they were always so aggressive. Majority of the security were 3GS. So I'm assuming they had some kind of subcontract or something. But yeah, huge amounts of aggression and huge amounts of police called on me. And, you know, they even had signs on the vaccination centers that said no photography, you know, which obviously piqued my interest, because, you know, why can't I record in this public area?
Well, that is strange. Yes, there is an increasing attempt by private landowners of various sorts to stop photography. It is actually still totally illegal from a public place. Now, when you go into private property, then there are questions about that legality, and they can say to you, you are not allowed to photograph, and they can forcibly remove you if you refuse to obey. So that's, as far as I understand it, that is the law for journalists and for citizens. What about the public who were around you at these times, say in the A&E? How did they respond?
Generally quite well. I mean, I like to think myself quite an approachable person. I'm always transparent with what I'm doing, and I like to approach people and ask for their opinions. So I was received pretty well most of the time. That isn't kind of auditing wide. You know, some people would get negative reactions from the public. However, as you know, different people have different styles of journalism. So some of them are dare I say it, quite antagonistic. So, you know, it's
almost provocative, you might say.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I have a little, and it's not, I don't want to say an issue, but there are many auditors out there. Lots of them I don't believe are genuine in terms of like holding the authorities to account. I think they're just out there to provoke reactions so that they can make videos for YouTube.
It's always, I'm afraid, this has always been the case with the media. It's always a bit of narcissism. People mm-hmm. just want to sort of see themselves. Maybe you can get a viral video if you get into a fight with somebody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've noticed that quite a lot. Yeah, I wouldn't like to delve in kind of like pick out specific people. But if you were to search for auditors or police interactions on YouTube, you'll find a significant group of people who often hang around together and go out together.
And I guess they try and lump you all together.
Absolutely, they do.
So did the police actually come round to your home, or was it just they were talking to you at while you were out recording?
No, I absolutely have been completely bullied by even the Somerset police over the last, since the very first lockdown. They once took me to court. They gave me a community protection notice, which essentially was to say that me filming in public was antisocial.
Well, hang on. What, just any filming in public?
I wasn't allowed to. I wasn't even allowed within 100 metres of a police station. Yeah.
Well, because what was that for?
Because they didn't like that I was filming them. It was the wording was, I have caused harassment, alarm and distress to members of Avon and Somerset Constabulary by recording them and uploading my videos to YouTube.
Well, I can understand that if every policeman or a man and woman that's coming out of there maybe going for their lunch is being followed.
No.
Is that what you were doing?
Absolutely not. 9 times out of 10, I would hope for a police officer not to come to me. I consider myself quite a decent auditor. I like to think that I put the right things first and I act the right way. And I go to every site hoping that everything's fine and nobody approaches me and tries to tell me what they usually tell me. For example, you can't film here. We know you're on private property, but your camera's pointing into public property.
Doesn't matter.
I mean, Section 33 of the Criminal Justice Act as well. I'm not sure if you know or anybody, but essentially, there's a very thin line between private and public place. You know, so if you have a shopping centre, for example, they might tell you that it's a private place. However, there it's filled with loads of shops, which are obviously open to the public.
Well, hang on. No, it's a private place. You see, what's happened with a lot of, for example, Broadmead or Cabot Circus here, is it was public land. It's now private land. So you'll find that they have their own private security there rather than the ordinary police, who they may be called if there's something serious. But this is part of, actually, I think it's Anna Minton's book, Ground Control. She's explained for many years now that many of our public spaces are being privatised. So even though we think of it as somewhere we can just walk through and it's private, like a shop or something, that actually it's owned by some private business with their own private security in there, Wesley.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. However, kind of what the law says with the, like I said, Section 33, is essentially if they have opening times, during those opening times, they are a public place.
Right.
When those times are closed, then obviously it would then be private, and things like trespass and potentially aggravated trespass could be an issue.
So how many times have the police taken action against you, and how successful have they been?
I was arrested 36 times between 2020 and at the end of 2021, and I was convicted 0 times. On 34 occasions, they dropped the charges. On 34 occasions, I refused to allow that to happen. The case was revived, and Avon and Somerset police had to stand in front of the judge and offer no evidence.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that's a lot of times. And can you maybe take us through a couple of notable charges that they levelled against you and occasions when you were arrested?
Well, there was it was always the same charge. It was always breaching of the community protection notice. Right. So it was essentially, I obviously queried it because I'm, you know, I know that I'm allowed to film in public. So when they gave me that, they told me not to cause harassment, alarm and distress. I basically printed off some paperwork from the National Police Chiefs Council, which was specifically about filming in public.
Right.
And it says on there that things like police should understand that filming of the police is now a feature of modern life, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, and also they're filming you. They've got these Absolutely. Body cams. I can remember an incident up in Clifton probably a decade or so ago where there was a big confrontation between some squatters who had occupied a building up there, and the owner brought something like 30 or 40 of his builders to come and retake the property to get some of their stuff, which was still in there, back. And so you had a potential massive confrontation. One police officer was sent to deal with it.
Wow.
And so he was talking to a spokesperson for the builders and a spokesperson for the squatters with the policeman in the middle. It started getting rather nasty. And the one of the builders said, oh, stop filming. And the policeman said, no, keep filming, keep filming. He said, I haven't got a camera. It's really important. This is recorded. And that, and it was, that helped to defuse the situation because they knew that they couldn't get away with anything. And even though they had a massive force of numbers, this one police officer actually stopped a fight happening, a big fight. I mean, an enormous confrontation.
I mean, fair play to him, that police officer. In my experience, I've really struggled to find police officers who don't escalate situations. I don't know whether that's because they're reacting to me personally or whether they're reacting to my camera. I'm not sure. I was always of the opinion that, you know, honest police officers should welcome being on camera. You know, to prove that or to show that they are upholding fundamental human rights.
In my experience, in my days doing visits into cells, we used to do that years ago, probably, well, 15 years ago, maybe 20 years ago, is that when you go into a police station, you can kind of sense the dodgy cops. They look, they smell bad, they look bad, they look guilty, they look suspicious. They look at you in a kind of dodgy way. What, who's this? What
are
they
doing? They're a gang.
Yeah, they are. They are
literally. We look at the definition of gang. You know, they have a base, a headquarters. They wear clothes that show that they are part of the same team. They are a gang. There's no two ways about it, in my opinion.
And this guy was a senior detective. He's sitting in the canteen having a cup of coffee, and the guy I was with, I think was one of the public relations officers for the police, was saying, "Stop talking. Someone's coming and sitting near us. We can't carry on talking here." It was very much similar to the BBC production office. Actually, it's very similar. Situation where it's like a war zone, even though it's many people's place of work. So anyway, what's your thoughts about this whole discussion we were having there with Martin about the purpose of the whole COVID 19 business, about whether it's actually a bioweapon? Is it designed to cause massive economic damage, as Martin's suggesting, or is it more about the measures used, as I was saying, which create the excuse for the vaccine, and everyone has to have a vaccine in order to get my life back to normal again?
I think from what I saw, from what I experienced, from the things that were said to me when I visited Nightingale hospitals or vaccination centres, nobody really knew why they were doing it. So I think it was probably more to do with trying to get us to have this vaccine. You know, it was almost a bit like they were poking us to see what they could get us to do. You know, how far could they push us? How long could they keep us in our houses? You know, as far as kind of like a biological weapon, I mean, it's believable also, you know. I guess we're way into the realms of speculation here, you know. So,
Well, I don't think so. I mean, actually, the evidence was out in end of January 2020 from the New Delhi Institute. This is the stuff I saw, this paper, which was non-peer review, which was released by the New Delhi Institute of Virology after a two-day brainstorming, looking at the genome, which had been published by the Chinese, saying this is unlikely to have occurred naturally. This was very early on, but this then, by the way, Zero Hedge suddenly lost their Twitter account. That got suspended for about a year that day, or the day after. But anyway, so let's have a listen now to the guy who's just about to become our Prime Minister. I don't think there's much doubt about that, Keir Starmer. In fact, Peter Mandelson says so. If you believe him, so does Nigel Farage, and the whole world knows that someone on high, some sort of god somewhere, has decided Starmer will be the next Prime Minister. That same god, it seems, has kneecapped the SNP through various police actions up there to put various, court cases on, a bit like Donald Trump, you know. So poor old Nicola Sturgeon, well, I mean, not that she's a particularly magnetic character, but it seems that's been deliberately done to help Starmer get in by allowing Labour to do well in Scotland. Anyway, you know, we never know about these things. We're speculating there. But one thing we can be sure of, that is during COVID, Keir Starmer said this.
Anti-vaxxers getting platforms and so on.
Well, we have to deal with the anti-vax campaigns because they will cost lives. And if we need to pass emergency legislation to deal with them, I'd be quite prepared to work with the government on that. We could pass it in a couple of days in Parliament. And the sooner we do that, frankly, the better, because for many NHS staff, it is really distressing. They're under huge pressure. And it's been building over the last few weeks and months. They're all doing their level best. They're all seeing that it's getting very, very difficult. And to come out and to have to confront that or even hear that is against the national interest. And if we need legislation, I'll sit down with Boris Johnson. We can draft it. We can pass it very, very quickly, because that misinformation will cost lives. We need as many people vaccinated as possible. We all need to give people confidence to be vaccinated as part of the programme. And it's also dealing with this misinformation that is out there.
There certainly was misinformation. Misinformation, I think, Wesley, on all sides. But I mean, he's saying, well, all the misinformation is coming from the anti-vaxxers.
No, that's a load of rubbish, isn't it? You know, they told us one thing, they told us a different, they locked us up, they let us out, you know. It's a load of to say that.
Well, what do you make of your prospects then? Have you managed to carry on since COVID doing these sorts of auditing work, filming?
I haven't been out kind of doing any of my compliance checks for almost a year now. To be honest with you, the treatment I got from the police made me pretty ill. You know, I had to safeguard my mental health, so I stopped. I've recently been going back out again, though. Feel a little bit more confident, and, you know, think since the Channel 4 documentary that came out about Avon and Somerset Police, I feel a little safer, because now the whole country, well, lots of people around the country have seen that documentary and have seen, you know, although extreme treatment, the kind of treatment that Avon and Somerset Constabulary kind of put on the residents of Avon and Somerset. So I
can you just tell us what were the main revelations in that documentary?
I mean, the fact that I think it was 4% of complaints actually were upheld against the police. Just some of the things I witnessed in it, you know, there was a young lady who, I don't want to say her name, who was up near Clifton Suspension Bridge having a mental health crisis. The police attended and grabbed her by the hair and picked her up and put her in a police car. And I know the young lady, or I knew the young lady. She actually jumped out of a tower block in Easton a couple of years ago, you know. So it just goes to show that, you know, Avon and Somerset Police are not in touch with the members of Bristol, I don't think. You know, I think there is very much an authoritarian regime with Avon and Somerset Police. I think they want to control rather than police.
Okay, so the term PINAC, PINAC is P-I-N-A-C-K, or P-I-N-A-C, pronounced PINAC, is often used amongst the auditors and citizen journalists. What does it mean?
Yeah, so PINAC is kind of lovingly the PINAC movement, what auditors under. So it stands for Photography Is Not a Crime. So essentially, you know, like you say, having a camera going out, filming from public land and reporting on certain things, it's not a crime. So it's kind of like one of the go-to phrases that...
It's a very good phrase. I know our journalists' union, they had a demonstration a few years ago in London. Photography is not a crime. Reporting is not a crime. This idea that journalists, once they stand together, can stand against the police. So have you ever actually caught the police breaking the law?
Oh, yeah, loads of times.
Really?
Yeah, whether it's parking on double yellow lines or idling your vehicle, you know. One of the things police officers do quite regularly is breach the Ripper Act. So you mentioned earlier about the body-worn camera. So essentially the police are governed or controlled by GDPR, so they have to let you know when they set their body-worn camera. So at the moment a police officer puts his body-worn camera on and doesn't tell you, he breaches the Ripper Act, which is breaking the law, you know. So it happens all the time, even if on a very small scale, you know, walking into a Greggs and accepting a free sausage roll because you're a police officer, you know. These kind of things are, it's kind of like, if you allow them to do one little thing without somebody saying, oh, why are you doing that, or should you be doing that, they will just continue and it will get on. I've interacted with police officers who have pulled up on white zigzags in front of traffic crossings just to go into shops to get food. You know, we couldn't do that.
These are the privileged. I remember years ago in Tetbury, which is near Highgrove, which is King Charles's house, with the cedar tree in the front garden that died. I'd never seen a cedar tree die like that. But anyway, his cedar tree did die, and after he bought Highgrove. And to see Prince Harry turn up to use the cash point in Tesco's, I think it was in Tetbury, and he just pulled right up on the zebra crossing, and he got out and he went into the cash point. He put his number in, and he could hear the whir. I've no idea how much money came out. It was a lot of money. And a friend I was with at the time was saying, "Was it for drugs? You know, what is this? What is going on here?" But anyway, so yeah, the elite, they do seem to have, the police have got this kind of "we're above the law" attitude.
Well, yeah, it's something I've said to many police officers. I said, why do you act outside of the law as opposed to upholding the law? And they don't ever like to be called out on this, you know, because like you say, they're the privileged ones. And I think a lot of them believe that because, you know, they get up and go to work and slip into that uniform and have that badge, I think a lot of them believe that that gives them the authority to tell people what to do and to do whatever it is they want to do. And I don't think... it's fair.
So you've been looking at the police stations, you've been looking at hospitals, these Nightingale things during COVID. Mm-hmm. Anything else?
Yeah, lots of fire stations. Firemen and firewomen seem to be really hospitable. I've been taken around fire stations, showed all the equipment.
Wow, you know, completely different.
Totally different. So, yeah, it just makes me wonder what the police are hiding, you know, because, there's been various conversations, but I think it kind of proves it with this small thing. Like, we have the ambulance service, the fire service, but we have the police force, you know. So I think that kind of says it all, really.
It does, yeah. Okay. So what about now? Are you still doing any of this kind of thing?
Yeah, I am.
And have you got a channel people can look up?
I do have a channel, yeah. So I know some of your listeners, actually, Tony, are also my subscribers on YouTube, because we had you actually were in one of my videos of a protest the other week.
Oh, yeah.
Somebody contacted me saying, that looks and sounds like Tony Gosling, ex-BBC presenter.
Well, I wasn't really a presenter. I did do a little bit of presenting at Wiltshire Sound, but I was more of a journalist and before that a researcher. Some people have spotted me. Oh god, yeah. The whole point of doing radio is no one can spot you. Actually, I do some TV, although I did the TNT radio television yesterday, talking about the Bilderbergers with Patrick Henningsen, but here I'll stop bragging on about that. But okay, so whereabouts can people find you?
You can find me on YouTube. I'm not on Twitter, so it's just basically YouTube is where my main content. You can find smaller content on TikTok, but I go by the name Audit Ed. So the word audited, split down audit to Audit Ed. Yeah.
Oh, okay. And what about using other channels rather than YouTube? Because surely this is so for example, some of your films that were put up, that people got prosecuted for doing that. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can whack those up without any fear now on some of the other channels.
Yeah, some of them. I was very new to social media when I started my YouTube channel. So that's why majority of my stuff is on there. There are bits on TikTok, and I do have a Facebook page as well, both under the same name. But I think now I've bought myself a nice new editing laptop, ready to start again. So I think now when we come back, we're going to be posting on way more social medias.
Okay, lovely. Can I just bring Martin back? Oh, he's going to behave himself this time and not talk about China too much. Martin? Yeah, Martin, this whole idea of public services like the police, the whole point was that we've now got police commissioners to look into when the police do things right and wrong. And we've now got a Labour commissioner for Avon and Somerset. Do you think that there is... I mean, this was a US system which was brought in here probably a decade or so ago. In the UK. Do you think there's... You know, is there is now a little bit more... of a check and a balance on the police, so there's somewhere people can go when they feel that the police have been up to no good?
Well, as you know, we used to have Police Federation spokespeople on our show back in those days when they were bringing the police and crime commissioners in. And of course, they weren't introduced in Northern Ireland because it would be to politicise the police in that way would be completely stupid in Northern Ireland. Because whoever won the election, the other community aren't going to accept that the police are going to be run by a politician. So that's why they didn't bring it in Northern Ireland. It was brought in England because it was David Cameron's idea from the United States. And I presume what they expected was that Tory police and crime commissioners would harass the police to do more about burglary and not so much about, other things which the, middle-class voters weren't that concerned about. I don't believe in police and crime commissioners at all. I think the police should be non-political, and that means that you can't have a political head of them. The thing about police and crime commissioners, as we said at the time, either they've got the power to tell the police what to do, in which case they're sticking their finger in, or they haven't got any power to tell the police what to do. Think, for example, about how to police demonstrations, in which case there's no point to them. I mean, I think the police in Bristol did a pretty good job on the Colston demonstration, which I was there. They basically realised that it was not in their interests or anybody's interests to have a big fight. And they didn't have a big fight. They videoed people doing what they were doing. They then advised the police, the Crown Prosecution Service, there was no point in prosecuting these people. But, of course, Priti Patel didn't want to hear about that. And so they all went to Bristol Crown Court. And as the police predicted, the jury refused to convict them. Now, that doesn't mean they'll always get it right. I've been in demonstrations in Bristol and elsewhere.
I mean, isn't this all a little bit arbitrary, Martin? Isn't this all a bit arbitrary? One demonstration that the police do like passes off fine. Another one they don't. They weigh in with their truncheons.
Well, listen, Tony, I'm an experienced demonstrator. I used to go to miners' pickets in the 1980s. I was at the Wapping picket line. I got pulled off that picket line and beaten up. I was arrested twice at Brixton and they tried to fit me up. This was in the early 80s. I would say that modern policing is less thuggish than it was back in the 80s. The Metropolitan Police in the 1980s, in my experience, were thugs.
Is that partly due to the presence of people like Wesley around and the fact that it might end up on the news
I think modern police officers, if they've got any brains, and of course some of them haven't, realise that they're under scrutiny all the time now. And that does change their behaviour. And I have to say, in Brixton itself, after the first riot, the police attitude changed quite a lot because previously they'd basically been bullying people outrageously, and they suddenly realised that politeness costs nothing, and that by shouting at people, you'd probably end up with a.
And so, Wesley, what do you make of the way the police have acted in the demonstrations? Like Martin's mentioned there, the Black Lives Matter, the Colston going in the harbour, and the Kill the Bill demonstration, which was policed in a very different manner.
Yeah, well, I was a bit shocked when Martin said that he thinks they policed the Colston demonstration well. I mean, I watched that demonstration from afar, and I watched police wade in with pepper spray and truncheons into groups of women and children.
That was a different day.
And that was right outside of the New Bridewell police station when the riot van was set on fire.
Yeah, that's a different demonstration. Yeah. And that was very different, as you say.
Yeah, the Black Lives Matter one was actually very peaceful, wasn't it? Everyone was kind of spaced out, weren't they? When I say that, not on drugs, but, they were distanced. Everybody wasn't bunched up together, and the police said, I suppose it will be all right.
Obviously, the police outside the Bridewell police station, were absolutely outrageous, the sentences that have been handed out to young people after that, because they came out of the police station armed up, which they didn't have to do, which then caused that whole demonstration to stop, and therefore created a confrontation that was totally unnecessary.
Well, yes, that's right. The police actually went into the demonstrators, decided to clear them out of the way, which they didn't do in the other case.
Sometimes they get it right and sometimes they get it wrong. I mean, that's the truth of the matter.
Yeah, it seems very politicised, a lot of this.
Altogether.
But have you got any advice, Wesley, for anybody that's thinking of doing this sort of thing?
Yeah, don't. They'll bully you. I will always say record the police, from afar if you can. Don't actively go out auditing because they will bully you. They will, if you are articulate and you don't swear and you do your research before and you go with a specific issue, they will hate you even more. So honestly, as much as I love the police to be held to account. I think any time a police officer interacts with you, you absolutely absolutely the very first thing you should do is record it, and the very second thing you should do is keep your mouth shut. But as far as going out and doing auditing and actively holding the police to account, I probably wouldn't suggest doing it, because it's very stressful and they will bully
you. You've sort of hinted that it's taken a bit of a toll on you.
It has. It hurt me for a time. It really did mess with my mental health. I was in a position where there were hundreds of other auditors out there, but none of them were getting the same kind of treatment as me. And I couldn't understand why I was different. There was auditors turning up to police stations wearing pig masks, sitting outside of police stations, handing out pork products under the guise of they were feeding emergency workers, you know, and these guys were allowed to do it. But if I walked up to a police officer and said, "Excuse me, sir, but do you have the express permission of your chief constable to operate covert surveillance on me?" I was antisocial. So it absolutely had a huge impact on my mental health. I had to think about my wife and my children and, you know, wonder how am I doing in my normal life when I'm coming away from auditing? What am I carrying with me? So at the time, a year and a half ago, I decided to stop. Yeah. So.
Okay, Wesley. Well, can you just finish by giving us a brief idea of where perhaps people can find you again?
Yeah, sure. You can get me on predominantly YouTube, Instagram, TikTok and Facebook, and their name is Audit Ed.
Audit dash Ed?
No, just Audit space Ed.
Audit space Ed. All right, Wesley Bear, thanks ever so much for joining us.
Nice.
Anyway, Martin, we'll be just picking up on this whole business of Diane Abbott. I think this has been some quite surprising developments this week with her. We've just heard today that the Labour Party finally decided that she will be allowed to stand. But let's have a listen what she had to say this time last weekend, when she made her speech in Hackney about how she was going to stand, and the Labour Party finally agreed. I imagine this is I'll be interested to hear what you've got to say about all this after we've heard from Diane Abbott last weekend.
I am so shocked and so alarmed about what is going on, because it is as if you are not allowed to be a Labour MP unless you're prepared to repeat everything the leader says. So what happened? What happened to political independence? What happened to representing your community? It seems if you want to be independent, if you want to speak up for people, if you want to represent your local community, you will find yourself banned with no due process, with no conversation, without even explaining to you why you are banned. So let me say to all of you this evening, I have campaigned over 40 years for the Labour Party. I have also campaigned for 40 years for equalities.
Right.
I've spoken up on race, I've spoken up on gender, I've spoken up on gay rights. And it is as if the party leadership is throwing all that in my face. Well, I am here to say that I will continue to speak up. I will continue to struggle, and by any means possible, I will be the candidate for Hackney North.
So that's Diane Abbott last weekend, Martin. It seems to me, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, the Labour Party were hoping that she'd throw in the towel under a bit of psychological pressure or bribery, quiet bribery, but she's decided to keep going, and today got her reward. She will be able to stand as a Labour candidate.
Yeah, I mean, she's been atrociously treated by Starmer, no doubt about it, but he's been forced to back down in this particular case. Although, of course, Jeremy Corbyn, he hasn't backed down on that, and he hasn't backed down. There's another young Muslim woman MP whose name just temporarily escapes me, who's also been taken off You know, she's been taken off the list of acceptable candidates. Underlying all of this, of course, is the Zionist takeover of the Labour Party apparatus. And we know that, you know, this is all documented in the Al Jazeera documentary where they did the undercover sting on Shai Mossad from the embassy, promising we've got £1 million to spend to get the Labour Party to do what we want. But of course, for the Labour Party, you're going to have a big issue as we go into the election campaign now. Some Labour MPs have voted for a ceasefire in Gaza. Some of them have not. And it's the position of the anti-war movement, of which I'm a proud member and active participant, we should not vote for anybody who's in favour of genocide in Gaza. And that rules out quite a substantial chunk of Labour MPs.
So what was the reason that Corbyn didn't manage to win this, but Diane Abbott did?
Well, Corbyn was a more high-profile target in a way, because he had been the leader. So by getting rid of him, it allowed Starmer to pretend or to present himself as somebody who'd completely swept with a new broom through the Labour Party. But of course, all that Jeremy Corbyn had done is to point out that the anti-Semitism allegations against him had been overdone for political reasons. And that's all he said. But of course, Starmer is in a position, using this control he's now got of the National Executive Committee, to do what he wants. And this is part of the problem from my point of view, as still a member of the Labour Party. All these people who've ripped up their party cards and walked away, it means that Starmer is in full control of the apparatus. It's very difficult, therefore, to do anything against him. But he's been such egregiously, you know, the treatment of Diane Abbott has just been so egregious because she was, you know, she was promised if she went and did anti-Semitism training, which she did, she would be readmitted to the party, which she was. And I think that they understood that she'd be readmitted to the party, but that she'd just go quietly. And of course, she's not going to do that because the people who voted for her in Hackney have been voting for her for years. She's continuously built her majority and she will no doubt be elected as the Labour MP.
Are they thinking that we'll deal with her later? Because she is actually, as one of the most senior, the oldest, longest serving Labour MPs, and a potential leadership challenger to Starmer at some point in the future. Are they going to deal with her later once we're into this next parliament, do you think?
I don't think she's too old to be a leadership challenger to Starmer. So I don't think that's going to happen. They will have to put up with her if she's elected. But of course, she won't have any real power unless there's a hung parliament, of course, which could happen if a substantial chunk of the left does not vote for Starmer's candidate.
So there doesn't really seem to be a lot of difference between the conservative view of anti-Semitism and the Labour view of anti-Semitism. Just before the election was called, and this was from a couple of weeks ago, the Tory MP and someone I'm really looking forward to seeing the back of, Michael Gove, gave a speech about anti-Semitism where he actually mentions our very own David Miller. And I know David was saying that he's organising a birthday party and he won't be inviting Michael Gove because Michael Gove mentioned him. And here he does mention Dr. David Miller. He's the sociologist from Bristol University, was sacked because he pointed out the fact that Jewish groups within, Zionist groups within the Bristol University, some of them were actually funded directly by the Israeli state from US money that's sent over there, and that they were part of the Israeli state, and so therefore they shouldn't really be seen as just ordinary kind of student organisations. But anyway, here's Michael Gove talking about all the trouble that there is in our universities and so-called trouble of anti-Semitism. Is it real anti-Semitism or fake anti-Semitism? We'll be hearing from Martin when we've heard from Michael Gove.
There were actually voices in academia who described the pogrom of October the 7th as decolonisation in action. Mavish Ahmed, assistant professor in human rights and politics at the LSE, responded to the Hamas massacre by saying that decolonization, quotes, is not a metaphor. And an associate professor at McMaster University in Canada, Emil J. Joseph, occupied the same intellectual terrain. Post-colonial, anti-colonial and decolonial are not just words you heard in your EDI workshop, he tweeted. And the effect of that rhetoric, those views, that celebration of resistance, has been felt by Jewish students as hostile and intimidating on campuses here in the UK. In Leeds University earlier this month, graffiti proclaimed that the faculty were funding a, quotes, effing genocide. the graffiti went on, Israel is harvesting Palestinian organs. There is a direct invocation of one of the oldest and most vicious anti-Semitic tropes, the blood libel. On Bristol University, the encampment posters claim that our media and politicians are lying because they are, quotes, Zionist-funded. Another anti-Semitic trope, the all-powerful Jewish conspiracy. At SOAS, School of Oriental and African Studies, part of London University, there's a declaration of, quotes, full solidarity with the Palestinian resistance, i.e. Hamas, and a proclamation that the student union is, quotes, a historically anti-Zionist space with a duty to uphold BDS. Yet again, telling Jewish students they are not welcome unless they deny their own identity. Anti-Semitism repurposed for the Instagram age. And alongside these student demonstrations, academics on the far left who advance decolonization narratives, such as David Miller, outline a program that tells Jews and Britons what their terms of surrender should be. He calls for the end of, quote, Zionist organizations, a program of, quotes, individual de-Zionization, and, quotes, abolishing the fact of the Zionist entity or any hope that it could ever be resurrected, as well as a re-education program to deal with the toxic effects in our country of Zionist ideas. How can Jewish students experience this as anything other than the most direct hostility and hate? And how can we allow it to continue unchallenged? We cannot.
So there's ex-MP, thank God, Michael Gove there, telling us all about how David Miller here wants to abolish the Zionist entity, that is getting rid of Israel altogether. But the thing is, the clear thing here, Martin, is this is again an attempt to conflate Jewishness and Zionism, which is seems to have been the game for many decades now, that the Zionists hold the franchise for Judaism.
Well, that's right, and there's plenty of Jews who resent that bitterly. You know, they're not, they don't speak on behalf of all Jews. The Israeli government does not represent all Jews. And Michael Gove is wrong to suggest that Jews aren't, by and large, you know, all Zionists. They're not. They just aren't. I mean, there's plenty of Jews in Bristol who are definitely not Zionists.
What about these feelings of hostility and intimidation, he said, that these Jewish students feel?
Well, if you're having a protest about something, if you don't like the people who are protesting, you don't have to talk to them. You can walk past them. You can just go on getting on with your life and have a lecture. And, of course, Jewish students also demonstrate with the Israeli flags. Are Palestinian students supposed to be intimidated by that? Are they supposed to say, we feel threatened? I think if Jewish students want to walk, you know, if they want to be pro-Zionist, they may. It's up to them. But I don't have to agree with that, nor does anybody else. It's in a university, you're going to find a spread of views. You're going to find people like Michael Gove, perhaps, if he was bright enough, and you're going to find people like David Miller, and you're going to expect to find that in a university. Of course you would expect to find that. The idea that there's only one set of views that are acceptable is ridiculous, isn't it? It's absurd.
Well, I mean, I think the idea is really here, what Gove is saying, is these people, anyone that's critical of Israel is a Nazi.
Well, he's saying anyone that's critical of Israel is an anti-Semite, which is just wrong. I mean,
But that's the dog whistle, isn't it? That's the dog whistle, because anti-Semites are Nazis.
Well, I mean, we could accuse the Smotrich, the Israeli minister, of being a Nazi because he openly said, I'm a fascist. He's allowed to call himself a fascist, but we're not. How absurd is that? And, of course, the Yabotinskyite right wing in Israel, the ones who are in charge now, Netanyahu's crew, they were, you know, in cahoots with Mussolini. They were in cahoots with Mussolini. And that's just the history. And, of course, Gove is, you know, the Zionist lobby is very, very powerful because they've captured the state in the United States, and therefore they can pay, you know, the state of Israel is essentially a great big welfare queen, and if it didn't have US money pouring in, it wouldn't be worth living there. Nobody would want to live there. And ultimately, of course, the question of whether there should be a two-state solution and all the rest of it, I think that's just history now. I think what we're beginning to talk about now is why can't Israel go back to the borders it was given in 1948? And if they can't do that, and they clearly can't do that, then they shouldn't be there at all. We went to war with Slobodan Milosevic for far less than what they've just done. We didn't just put sanctions on them, we bombed them, we killed them. And that's war. And that's war. Warfare, I'm afraid, Michael, isn't just about, talking. And I'm afraid if the Israelis are going to kill the number of people they're going to kill, ultimately the Golan Heights are going to be recaptured from them by the Syrian army, backed up by the Russian army. And if you think you're going to stop them, you're a fool.
Okay.
The West is losing the war in the Ukraine, and they ain't going to win the war in Israel either.
Well, we shall see. We discussed the implications of these legal judgments for MPs, and one of the stories I missed last week, although I think I did circulate it out with the newsletter, it was from the excellent Middle East Eye. I mean, there are very many, the Electronic Intifada, there's also Middle East Monitor, various publications that focus on the Middle East. I think there's one called Palestine Chronicle, which is better. But to me, the best is the Middle East Eye. No doubt that there are attempts to try and destroy that. It's just got all sorts of really good authors, such as Jonathan Cook, based here in Bristol, the ex-Guardian writer, and Peter Oborne. They do seem to be the most professional lot. And one of their articles, Martin, last week was the UK five ministers are included in the Gaza war crimes complaint submitted to the police, the 60-page complaint by the legal advocacy group, ICJP. Accuses Israel of using starvation as a weapon of war and willfully causing great suffering. And it mentions the names of five ministers specifically who have materially aided this, Martin. So I don't think it's completely out of the question that some of the people named in this document, for example, the ministers here who've been supporting the Israelis, might at some point get their collars felt and might be a little bit nervous about carrying on, thinking maybe it's a good idea to get some clean skins in there from the Labour Party and the Labour Friends of Israel, because these guys might have their collars felt by the Metropolitan Police.
And so the Labour Friends of Israel may also be fingered up by the Metropolitan Police as well. This is the thing. The legal position has moved quite dramatically in recent weeks. And, of course, lawyers will be telling that behind the scenes that if you are complicit in genocide, you are also... That was established at Nuremberg. If you don't have to have done it to be guilty. One of the people that was sent down at Nuremberg, as Farouk Sadiq, was saying at one of the recent demonstrations, he'd never done anything to the Jews. He'd never killed anybody. He'd never been a camp commandant. What he was sent down for is because he was the editor of the Nazi newspaper, and he was the one who created all the hatred by printing the stuff, and he was hanged. He was hanged.
So these are all lawyers. Most MPs are lawyers, aren't they? They will know the implications of this, surely.
Well, you'd think so. I mean, of course, the question is the law going to be enforced, like a lot of things? You know, there is a law against genocide. The International Court of Justice has evoked it, as had the International Criminal Court. And is it going to be, who's going to enforce it? But it will make it difficult, for example, if going forwards, for Israeli politicians to travel abroad. They'll have to just stay home.
Absolutely right. When they go on their holidays, they're going to be biting their nails, thinking, am I going to be arrested when I get off the plane? They don't like that, do they?
No, they don't. And, of course, that is the answer. Of course, the other answer is war. You know, there's legal recourse, and then there's war. The Palestinians have an absolute right to resistance in international law. Some of the things they did on October the 7th were regrettable, but then we did quite a lot of regrettable things in World War II, didn't we? We firebombed Dresden. Was anybody ever punished for that? And, of course, the Israeli state itself was created by openly, avowedly terroristic groups, the Irgun and the Haganah and the Lehi, who killed loads and loads of people. But they were never punished. They just got a state out of it. Hamas is a mirror image of that. What we should have done, looking back as a British person in the 1940s, we should have crushed the Jewish terrorists, Zionist terrorists. Let's not call them Jewish terrorists, let's call them Zionist terrorists. They should have been crushed with ruthless determination, and then we wouldn't be in this mess now. But they're going to have to be crushed in the long run.
Well, the first MP to really bring this up, as soon as the invasion of Gaza took place, was a chappie called Crispin Blunt MP. I'm not sure if you remember. He was on the news almost immediately saying, oh gosh, this is a little bit tricky here, because anybody who's supporting genocide of the Israelis here could be prosecuted. And the next day there was a story about him being accused of sexual harassment, and he went quiet after that. Well, he's now standing down at the general election. We've heard just in the last couple of weeks weeks. He's now standing down. Crispin Blunt, Conservative MP for Reigate. And I wonder if there are going to be any left in the in Parliament in the, after the next election who are actually have the guts to say what the law is. You may be right, Martin, that that the law will pretty much fail to operate because there's a kind of a gang, a sort of cult really running the show, and everybody who's an MP knows that if you step out of line and if you speak against the agreed narrative on Israel, that you will find yourself out on your ear.
Well, all sorts of pressure will be open and covert pressure will be put on people not to do what they're supposed to do. But I think the legal judgments are now becoming quite emphatic. And this is going to cause problems because you can't get out of this. This is now the legal position. And I think Starmer is obviously going to be the prime minister, maybe not with an overall majority, partly because of this stuff. But he's immediately going to be coming under attack because he's not going to call for Israel to stop doing what it's doing. And he's not going to stop arms going to Israel. And he's not going to call for sanctions on Israel, even though the Spanish and the Norwegians and others are thinking we've got to reconsider the EU's economic relationship with Israel. He's not going to do any of that because he wants to please the Americans. Then, of course, he might end up having Trump to deal with, who he doesn't particularly want to deal with. But Trump, of course, is even more belligerent than Biden, if that were possible. But what Britain needs to do is to cut loose from this American-Israeli alliance. We just need to get out of it.
Is Starmer going to be the man to do that? I don't think he is.
No, he's not. But, of course, he's going to find it very, very difficult. Because as we go forwards now, possibly millions of people are going to die of starvation. And he is going to be to blame. He is going to be the man who...
Well, maybe he will have his collar felt if he's been supporting that. Anyway, looking at the Labour Party, just generally around the election and the stories around the election campaigning, the UK's Labour Party this week has welcomed the Czech billionaire Kretinsky's assurances on Royal Mail. Well, this Czech billionaire is being allowed apparently to buy Royal Mail by the Tories, and as usual the opposition is not opposing anything, so this is yesterday. Britain's main opposition Labour Party will ensure that assurances given by Czech billionaire Daniel Kretinsky concerning Royal Mail are adhered to if the party wins the July general election. Kretinsky's investment vehicle EP Group, which has agreed a £3.6 billion takeover deal for Royal Mail, its parent company, International Distribution Services, has included provisions concerning employee benefits, among other things, as part of the takeover. So this is bizarre that some Czech billionaire is going to be in charge of who gets delivered mail, where and when. It's quite obvious what will happen. There will be some sort of... hoops for the employees to jump through, and they'll be being slowly booted out, and also they'll be reducing deliveries, increasing costs. This is just this is supposed to be a part of our infrastructure which is just being flogged off to this billionaire.
Yes, and in France and the United States, two other capitalist democracies, they still have a publicly owned post office. We don't have it here because of the stupidity of the Thatcher era.
It wasn't the Thatcher era, was it?
It was Vince Cable and the coalition.
The coalition government, yeah.
Privatised the post office. But, of course, the whole philosophy of having everything controlled by foreign billionaires is, it's passé, really, isn't it? I think the problem that the Labour government is going to have is that they're not going to get a honeymoon on the economy at all. Because I think that the Western European economy, including Britain, is going to go down the drain now because of the blowing off the Nord Stream 2 pipeline by the Americans and possibly by the British, because the British deep state may have been involved in that. And, of course, we can't discuss that. You know, we've got an election and everybody's talking about all sorts of things, but we can't talk about blowing up of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which is clearly a criminal act of horrendous proportions. It's going to condemn a generation of European young people to unemployment and misery. And that's done by the Americans to the Europeans. And all we can do is cheer them on as they carry on cheering on the Israelis to do what they're doing.
Martin Stanford on LBC this week had a, I think, really fascinating discussion. Thanks for whoever sent this in, because I was actually listening to it, and someone prompted and reminded me. Her name is Rachel Henry. She's from something that used to be called the Tax Justice Network. It's now called Tax Justice UK. Martin, the idea is that the public are such idiots that all we just do is we just talk about we're going to have tax cuts or not. And they don't actually talk about who's going to be taxed. The idea that we're going to tax the super rich doesn't even enter the equation. It's either tax cuts or no tax cuts, isn't it?
Well, that's right. It's the way of the framing of the the Tories have been talking about they're trying to get some tax cuts to bribe their voters. But of course, after the collapse of the banking system in 2008, and it was bailed out, and then austerity was imposed on the rest of the population, so that they've died younger. People have started dying younger than they used to do, which hasn't been happening for over 100 years. And that is simply those people are being sacrificed to the super wealthy who were kept. You know, they've done very, very well out of the whole crisis. They're actually better off now than they were before the crisis.
Well, listen, they're massively better off. The super rich did incredibly well out of COVID, some of them up to three or four times their wealth.
The banking collapse and COVID, they made a fortune.
What's happened is every one of these crises has funneled massive amounts of money to the super rich. I mean, not even to mention Rishi Sunak's loan scheme, where tens of billions of pounds went missing of government money that the government, we have, as the public, have got to pay back. But that money's just sort of vanished in a puff of blue smoke. But what about this idea? I mean, there is this attempt, it seems, that both of the main parties are complicit in, which is really, I think, an international financier's trick, which is to have a bit of inflation, not masses, but all the time. The tax thresholds of all sorts, whether it's inheritance tax or whether it's just simply income tax thresholds, are kept the same. It's called fiscal drag. So as inflation starts biting, so more and more people, so this is like middle income earners and even lower income earners, Martin, are stung by the higher rates of income tax rather than the lower rates, because these tax thresholds are kept deliberately static as inflation and people's incomes and their outgoings all go up, but the tax thresholds don't, meaning that more and more people are being caught in these higher levels of tax.
Well, it is called fiscal drag, and why governments sometimes allow it to happen is because it takes demand out of the economy without increasing interest rates.
Well, we don't want any demand taken out of the economy. People have got no money to spend anyway.
No, but if we've got inflation, you've got to take demand out of the economy to bring it down. Okay, we haven't.
No, I don't think you have. But I mean, there is one. I mean, that is a view, Martin.
Or you increase interest rates.
That
or
is.
You can have an incomes policy, which is what we used to do in the 60s and 70s.
That sounds much more. Sounds much more like it. The idea that you're going to be increasing interest rates. Surely, this is. I mean, we've been through this argument before. This means that all prices have to be put up, and then that gets fed onto the consumer. But anyway, look, we're not experts, neither of us, in taxation. I mean, someone who is this woman, her name is Rachel Henry from Tax Justice UK. So here she is speaking on LBC to Martin Stanford earlier this week, really about this whole idea of can we tax high income earners? Why don't we just tax them, not low income earners?
Wealthy people also say that they are willing to pay more tax. You poll millionaires, 66% of them say, actually, we think that our taxes are too low and we would be willing to invest more in public services.
Right. That's a valuable fact to report. Let me just ask you to clarify, though. At the moment, we have income taxes. We don't actually have wealth taxes. So if I've got no income, but I actually own £3 million houses, I don't pay any tax, maybe.
Well, you have different taxes that on wealth. So you have capital gains tax, you have inheritance tax. But yes, we don't currently have a wealth tax on assets.
Should we have a wealth tax?
Absolutely should. So if you tax people who had assets over 10 million, that is only 20,000 people in the UK. It is a tiny amount of people, 0.04% of the population. If you tax them 2%, it would raise 22 billion a year. That is a vast sum that could really go into funding public services. It's a tiny amount of people, and it's also incredibly fair, considering that very wealthy people often accrue a lot of their income from their assets. Wealth creates wealth. So we have capital gains tax that is already set at a lower rate than income tax. There is absolutely no defense for that. Why are wealthy people paying lower taxes than working people?
Well, there's a separate argument about capital gains tax being lower might help business investment and the growth in the economy. Can I just... let me just do that in passing. Is that not fair comment?
One point I would definitively make is that the fact that we have public services being hollowed out because we are not raising enough tax revenue is a huge lag on growth. You have 8 million people on the NHS waiting list, too sick to work. You don't have the right skills investment in the UK. You don't have businesses planning for net zero. Even the IMF have said that the UK will not achieve economic growth if it does not look to fix its holes in public services. So actually, we are now in a state in the UK where the hollowing out of public services and the fact that we are not raising enough tax is actually a huge lag on growth.
So that's Rachel Henry speaking from the Tax Justice UK. I'll put a full version of that interview, which is about maybe 7-8 minutes long. Really detailed stuff about how the tax system works. He used to be a chap called John Christensen that ran the Tax Justice Network. She seems to have taken over from him, and they've changed the name a little bit to Tax Justice UK. But at least someone, Martin, is talking about wealth taxes. I mean, for the super rich, what she's saying there, the top 20,000 people in the country who could supply many tens of billions of pounds to the Exchequer.
Well, there's a case in economic theory that you shouldn't tax income or profits. So no corporation tax, no income tax, but you tax wealth and capital gains, because capital gains are made in your sleep. You know, if you own a large property portfolio and there's a property bubble bubbling, then you just earn money. And of course, you've done nothing to earn that money. You've not contributed anything. You're essentially just cornering the market, and you keep yourself in a stance which you've become accustomed. And an efficient economy taxes away capital gains, but allows people to make good profits without taxing those profits, and to earn good money without taxing their income. But of course, that would be moving towards socialism. In other words, expropriation of the people who own the assets.
Well, it makes much more sense than
we're going to take it all off you.
There's been a row this week, hasn't there, about VAT? I mean, that's expropriating from the poor.
That's why VAT is a regressive tax. So poorer people proportionately pay more. And of course, the tax system used to be, at the end of the Second World War, in Britain and the United States and most other countries, the top rate of tax, income tax, was 95%, 96% in the US. And the sky didn't fall. It didn't fall. The wealthy carried on being pretty wealthy. They still had a much better lifestyle than the ordinary population, but they just had to pay up more in tax.
I mean,
the welfare state,
yeah,
and the US.
The crazy thing about all this is that many of these wealthy, as Rachel says there, are happy to pay more tax. They've done the surveys to find this out, to ask wealthy people, well, you don't mind paying a bit more tax. And yet the government doesn't want to tax them. It would prefer to tax the middle classes and the working classes.
Well, the people that she's talking about are just millionaires. But of course, don't forget, you've got your billionaires, and they do not want to pay tax because they want to run everything. They need their billions so that they can set up philanthropic foundations.
And also they can run. They can do lawsuits and this sort of thing.
Yeah. I mean, there's a Polish-English economist called Kalecki who wrote stuff in the 1950s. In the 1950s and into the 1960s, the capitalism was being managed on a very short leash. So in other words, trade unions were given a lot of say, wages rose every year. There was a lot of public investment through all sorts of things like health services and education. And it worked. It worked. Living standards rose, and it worked very well. And Kalecki said the problem is that not that this doesn't work, it does work, but at a certain point the wealthy classes are going to get fed up with it, and they're going to want to go back to the way it was before the war. And of course, at the time, he was regarded as a bit of a doomsayer. You know, that's not going to happen, what you're talking about. But of course, with hindsight now, we can see exactly what happened there. The wealthy classes wriggled out of what we had them in harness, basically, and they've wriggled out of it. And of course, the results have been absolutely predictable. The economy has got less efficient, more unequal. And of course, we're now facing peer competitors in Russia and China who don't believe in wealth inequality. They've got quite a lot of wealth inequality in both Russia and China, but they're determined to get it down. In our country, the Tories aren't determined to get it down. They like it. That's what makes them feel happy. And that's why our economy has been...
I mean, there's not really any difference between them and the Labour Party, really. I think he was the... what was it? Peter Mandelson's quote about there is nothing wrong with wanting to be filthy rich.
Yes, I'm very relaxed about people being
that's
filthy
it.
Rich.
Yes.
And, of course, what's actually happened in the Labour Party is that there's the massive amounts of money being funneled to the new Labour Party leadership from wealthy people. And, of course, what they want is we don't want our taxes increased.
Well, one of those wealthy people is likely to be this... it's a bizarre name, you know, Cretin. Royal Mail investor speaks out to oppose Czech sphinx Daniel Kretinsky's $3.6 billion takeover, says the current management can add more value to the struggling firm. But that doesn't really matter, does it? Because these sorts of deals are brokered in places like Davos. Yeah, we want your postal service. And it seems Keir Starmer is just quite as happy to bend over as Rishi Sunak is.
Well, don't forget, this is because of the first-past-the-post electoral system. He doesn't have to find votes on the left. He's got to.
No, well, it's not really, is it? It's because he's not interested in Westminster.
Well, no,
he says
not.
He's much happier chatting away with people at Davos.
Well, if he thinks he's going to just be managing a sort of managed decline of capitalism in Britain, he's deluded.
Well, he's actually kind of a salesman. Isn't he really just a sort of salesman? He's just offering, you know, a kind of fire sale of various British assets to the highest bidder. And he calls it investment.
What he's doing is
we're getting loads of inward investment. Aren't we doing well?
Well, we're not getting loads of inward investment, though. That's the problem, because our economy is so messed up, nobody wants to invest in it. And that's been true since 2016 and the referendum on Brexit. There's been no substantial investment coming into Britain. And, of course, in the long run, that means that your economy starts to go down.
And that's why it's such a ridiculous game. This idea that you've got to try and fish around for some investor to come and put some money in to buy your stuff up. Surely you should be owning and controlling that stuff yourself. Otherwise, you're not even really a sovereign country at all.
Well, that's right. And, of course, this kind of super uber capitalism has been unchallengeable for a generation. But it's now being challenged because other people who don't believe in it are doing different things. So you've got the Chinese have got a nationalized banking system. They ultimately, the Bank of China controls the money supply, really does control it. And of course, in Russia, you've got a nationalized army.
So what do you make of this great British energy, Martin, that the great British energy that Rachel Reeves and Keir Starmer are trumpeting and Ed Miliband? I mean, this is another aspect to all of this. We keep seeing these people who we thought we'd got rid of regurgitated now in the Labour Party particularly. I think the idea was back in the days of the European Union, these people would be given a nice job as a European commissioner and then maybe phone up someone in Eastern Europe and threaten to kill them. That was their role as a European commissioner, all these appointees of failed politicians from around Europe. So, you know, people who'd cut their teeth as professional liars, been rumbled by the electorate, and then they suddenly in charge of the whole thing as commissioners in Brussels. But, I mean, that surely is, you know, is the role of somebody. I mean, wasn't Mandelson also a commissioner? I'm not sure. But, I mean, it seems to me that that's why we've got people like Miliband turning up again as part of the election team. I mean, the guy's a loser. We know he's a loser. What's he even doing there?
Well, Jeremy Corbyn's a loser as well, and he should be standing as a Labour candidate. People have been in the Labour Party as long as Ed Miliband. There's no deselection. We've never had. You
Are
know,
we going to have Tony Blair selling Keir Starmer?
Well, I have no idea. The point is that these people are in line with US policy. That's what they're there for. They know what they have to do. We have to be in line with the US. We cannot get too far ahead. Although, of course, what Cameron has done by saying that British missiles can be used to fire into Russia before the Americans came round to saying the same thing is that the Russians now see us in particular as a particularly belligerent little chihuahua. And they're going to possibly give us a good kick before polling day.
Maybe. What do you make, Martin? What do you make of this? Do you make of this interregnum we've got now? Really, the king's in charge, isn't he?
Well, it's in any election campaign in any country when the election's on. There's not much else going on because you've got to settle that before you can settle anything.
There's no MPs, there's no debate, no discussion, it's just the military and King Charles.
Well, that's what happens in any country when you have an election, doesn't it? There's a period, how long or short it is, where you don't have it. I mean, of course, Zelensky was supposed to stand for election and he's now illegitimate. His term in office ended on May the 20th and the Russians have already said we're not going to accept him. As a legitimate.
So he's kind of like King Charles, really. He's just going to go on and on with no elections or anything.
Well, we need to get rid of the monarchy, Tony. I'm a Republican. Absolutely. We don't need a monarch. But there you are. Most people still think we do. So until they change their minds, we're stuck with it.
Well, that's not really what I'm saying, is it? The idea is that the monarchy is having no election for your president is what they're doing over in Ukraine. But anyhow, look, let's just... You don't think it makes any difference that the... security services, your MI6, the Army Council, and the rest of them, maybe GCHQ directors, get together and they think, well, there's no government now, we can play a few tricks.
Well, they do that all the time anyway. I mean, the fact that there's supposedly a government doesn't mean that they're not getting up to stuff.
Okay, well, it's interesting to hear what you had to say about that. Anyway, let's go to Peter Mandelson and have a listen to his fears that he inadvertently caused Rishi Sunak to call an election. But anyway, just his general thoughts about who he thinks is going to win and why the election happened in the first place. And I'll put a full version of this on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later. Mandelson being one of this kind of trio who are puppeteers for Keir Starmer, including Blair and Campbell.
A hung parliament or does Labour win, and if so, by how many seats? How big a win are they looking at?
I think if the electorate pick up a smell that the outcome of this, after all this time of waiting, after everything we have gone through as a country, is going to be a hung parliament in which the Conservatives finally are able to cling on by their fingernails to power, I think that it will be the greatest motivator to get people out of their homes on polling day to vote Labour, or in some cases, obviously, to vote Liberal Democrat. I think the time for change is absolutely unstoppable.
Is there a chance you could still have a hung parliament, though?
I think it's very unlikely that there'll be a hung parliament. I think the country will act and vote decisively. They will not return the Conservatives to a fifth term of government, not just because it's never happened before, but what on earth would you be voting for? What on earth would you expect to happen if the Conservatives got back to a fifth term? Not even they expect or want to have a fifth term in government, let alone the rest of the country. They want to get on with the business of sorting themselves out, fighting over the soul and future direction of the Conservative Party. You know, the right are going to take on the far right in the Conservatives. That old rump of more moderate One Nation Conservatives will be standing at the touchline. They're going to be observers at what is going to be one ferocious, mighty great battle within the Conservative Party. First, of who takes the blame and the responsibility for their defeat, but who now is in the best position to capture the Conservative Party and to take it in the right wing or the further right wing direction that they're battling over amongst their MPs and activists.
Well, if there is a small cabal of a handful of people that secretly rule Britain and get rid of any kind of politicians that don't do as they're told, then you can bet your bottom dollar Peter Mandelson is on that committee. He always seems to be well ahead of everything, Martin. In fact, in there he's talking about what's going to happen after the Tories lose the general election. And also his prediction is that Labour will win a majority.
Well, I think on the prediction, he's probably right. I don't think it would be good for the country to have an overall majority for the Labour Party. I think people should vote to get the Tories out. But that doesn't necessarily mean voting Labour. I mean, I'm in North Herefordshire at the moment, and the Conservatives' main opposition is coming from the Green Party. And, of course, in this constituency, those who want the Tories out, they've got to vote Green. I think that different parts of the country have got different political histories. You know, people in North Wales have got a different political history than people in Kent. You know, we're not an homogenous society in that sense. And, of course, what the Labour leadership want is they want carte blanche to do what they want and not to be dependent on the left of their own party or any other parties.
I mean, the Lib Dems are very opportunist.
They're not going to get 50% of the vote. Even if they do have an overall majority in Parliament, they won't get 50%.
Aren't the Lib Dems rather an
opportunist? I've just failed to get 50%.
The Lib Dem are an opportunist lot, really. They sort of hang around there. And they know that when a central government is unpopular of the Conservatives, then the Lib Dems can pick up votes, whether that's a general election or in the local elections. Here, for example, we had Jeff Gollop, who was on this programme a few months ago, talking about how the Labour Authority with Marvin Rees here was about to spend a lot of money, which then didn't get spent after Jeff and his friends were campaigning for it. Jeff is a Conservative. So they were going to be spending more money than they were even hoping to get in from the working poor to tax the working poor, which is an absolutely disgusting way to spend public money. But Jeff pointed it out. He's been booted out, and now in is the Lib Dem Stephen Williams, who famously advised successfully when he was in the Department for Communities and Local Government that there should be no review that the fire brigades were pushing for into flammable cladding. So this is the way politics works. It's the local people just don't know what they're voting for. They're voting for a party, not a person. And in fact, in a way, I feel Bilderberg is a similar thing, where actually it's not about the individuals who are there. It's the massive companies, Martin, that they represent. It's the same with the parties in elections, isn't it?
Well, I think the Liberal Democrats are going to have a good campaign because they're going to take lots of Tory seats. Because wealthier people in the posher parts of the country are fed up with the Tories, but they can't bring themselves to vote Labour, so they will vote Liberal Democrat. The Liberal Democrats used to be the main opposition here in North Herefordshire, but of course they've disappeared now, and the Greens have taken their role. So this is going to be quite an interesting election to see how the votes crumble and who gets what. But I guarantee you that the Labour Party will not get 50% plus of the vote. In South Africa, the ANC, which has been ruling since the 1990s, didn't get 50% of the vote. And because it's a proportional system in South Africa, they will have to find some coalition partners, either on the left or on the right, if they're going to be the government. They got 40-something percent of the vote, which is about what Starmer will hope to get. But, of course, he will have a massive majority on that. It's not allowed in other countries.
Well, I mean, Peter Mandelson is not the only person that is convinced that the Labour Party is going to win and Keir Starmer will be the Prime Minister very soon. Another one is Nigel Farage.
The legal immigration issue. I mean, can you believe that a political party that promised net migration of tens of thousands a year in successive manifestos, and then a Brexit government, I mean, elected to reduce the numbers coming into Britain, has allowed for two consecutive years 1.2 million people to settle. And so, yes, I don't think we can talk about housing. I don't think we can talk about schools. I don't think we can talk about the NHS or anything, even infrastructure, unless we talk about the exploding population that's been caused by, firstly, a Labour Party that opened the doors and a Conservative Party that accelerated it. So, yes, I think it is the number one issue.
The Prime Minister would point to the fact that year on year, for the figures of last year, they were down on the preceding year. He would argue that, and if he gets his Rwanda plan off the ground, that is the sort of issues or the sort of factors that would get the numbers in check.
Well, first things first, the previous year's figures came in at 606,000 until they were revised to 745,000. This year's have come in at 685,000, so by the time they're revised, I'll bet you they're even higher than the year before. Okay. And even if they were down, but Nick, you know, from the late 40s to the year 2000, net migration was 30,000 a year. We're now talking 750,000. I mean, the numbers are incomprehensible. They're so big. And when it comes to Rwanda, well, I'm here in Dover. Keir Starmer has nothing to say. Literally nothing to say. We'll smash the gangs. Well, how many times on your show have you heard ministers say we're going to smash the drugs gangs? And how much success has that brought in the United Kingdom? The point is, if you're a criminal trafficking gang in Calais, you could make 2 to 3 million euros a week. At the height of summer, you could put every one of them now in prison. More would volunteer to come forward. The rewards are so high. And as for Rishi Sunak, well, I think the reason he called the early election is he'd made the big promise that planes would go to Rwanda in July. He realised they wouldn't. He feared that would lead to a big increase in support for Reform UK. No, let me make this clear to you. No planes are going to Rwanda with those that don't want to go. It isn't going to happen. And why? Because there is a court in Strasbourg that will say no to it. And this is the level of dishonesty of this debate. And look, we may choose to stay part of the ECHR, just as we could have chosen to stay part of the European Union. But you cannot stay part of that court and have control over those coming into your country. And I believe, as Brexit Britain, we should not be beholden to a foreign court.
So that's Nigel Farage. Martin, I don't suppose you agree with him on any point other than that Labour are going to win.
No, I don't. Most of the people are conflating asylum seekers with legal migrants. Most of the people coming into the country are legal migrants who have job offers to work in the health service and care, mostly. And in actual fact, because of the money so rubbish, British people don't want to do those jobs.
But surely many of these tens of thousands are coming across in these boats. And often the people who are coming, well, some of them die when they come in the boats, but also when they come over, they're basically in the hands of gangs until they pay back the money.
Listen, there are two sorts of migrations coming in. One is what you might call asylum seekers.
Yeah, you've just said this, and I think we know what we're saying. Well, we're talking, I ask you now to address the issue of the boats, not the legal migrants, please.
All right, because the legal migrants outnumber the people coming across.
Yeah, we know. We know that. You've said that three times now.
It's okay, but I think it's important to stress it, because it's quite important.
Four times, maybe. Can we just talk about the boats, Martin? Actually, Nigel Farage has made an excellent point there. He's saying, well, look, all this stuff about we're going to address the criminal gangs, the Labour Party is saying, is total poppycock. That's what the Tories and everyone else has been saying for years.
If there is a demand, there will be a supply. We shouldn't have invaded Libya. We shouldn't have bombed Iraq. We shouldn't have invaded Afghanistan. But Nigel Farage and people like him went,
people are not coming from these countries. They're coming from places like Vietnam. It's basically a pipeline organised by organised crime, and it's not very much necessary to do with any of the wars. It's just for cheap migrant labour. And you can understand why people might want to do that.
They paid to come here, but they can't work until they've been processed. And the Tories have taken the view that if we make it very difficult to apply, then people will stop coming. They won't. And as Nigel Farage correctly points out, Tony, if you smash the criminal gangs in Calais tomorrow, other people would take over. Because the world is the global economy is in crisis now. And that's because of 30, 40 years of neoliberal policies all over the world. In Egypt, in Mexico, in Africa, we rammed this stuff down their throats, and therefore they couldn't put their own people to work.
Well,
in
we did from
country.
Time to time. I think you're exaggerating it. Most of it is economic migration. Most of it is actually economic. Most of it's economic migration. But anyway,
well,
look,
most of it
George.
Isn't,
yes, it is.
It is economic migration. They've all got job offers in the health service.
Yes, good. Well, thank you. Thank you. Thank you for agreeing. Thank you for agreeing with me. Anyway, George Galloway is also obviously and. Many of his friends are standing for the Workers' Party. What do you make of their chances?
Well, in certain constituencies, they're going to have a good chance, especially if the local Labour MP has voted for hasn't voted for a ceasefire in Gaza.
They are actually
big
more
Muslim population. They can do very well.
They are actually more than just a one issue. But I mean, okay. So let's have a listen to the leader and the deputy leader of the Workers' Party now. I mean, I'm specifically avoiding the talks, which many people, I'm sure, have heard blaring out of their TVs and radios during the week by Starmer and Sunak. I think this whole idea of having a TV debate, as Ian Jenkins pointed out in Wales earlier on today on Facebook, is that the idea of having a TV debate between Starmer and Sunak, to me, makes me sick. I don't want to watch it. I'm not interested in what they've got to say. I don't think any of the real issues are going to come out there. What they do need, and it would be good to have, is to have some of the other candidates, the Greens, Lib Dems, SNP, etc. But the idea that it's just these two in a TV debate, Martin, surely this isn't a TV debate at all. It's just a prearranged, scripted play.
Well, if you remember some years ago, Cameron and George and Brown had a debate, but Nick Clegg kind of elbowed his way in. So this is really a matter for the public, for the broadcasters to decide who's going to be allowed to speak and all the rest of it.
Yeah, well, the broadcasters have let us down, basically.
They want to everything to stay in the centre ground, don't they?
Yeah, it's pathetic. It's absolutely pathetic of the broadcasters, I think it's ITV this time, to insult their viewers to such an extent they're going to have these two idiots trying to make out that it's some sort of debate, which it isn't. And it, you know, it's the most ridiculously absurd general election I think I've ever seen, which is why I've been using in these clips from the goodies at the beginning of the show over the last couple of weeks, and similar things I think I'll be using, because there's an element of absurdity to that TV debate specifically, but generally with the two main parties. And I would totally agree with George Galloway when he says two cheeks of the same backside.
As we cross the threshold of 5 Hiroshima bombs dropped on a concentration camp called Gaza, 75,000 tons of high explosives in the last hour, a family of 11 have been entirely wiped out in the Gaza Strip in a military attack on terrorists, except virtually every one of the 11 members in the family were children, as well as their mother, of course.
So George Galloway, former Labour MP there, Workers' Party leader. But although he talks a lot about Gaza, Martin, it's not just by any means a single-issue party. They're also wanting to re-industrialise Britain, amazingly.
Well, I mean, that's a great aspiration. But of course, it's actually doing that requires you need a huge push, popular push to do it, and you need a plan. And of course, they are putting forward what I would regard as sensible solutions. But of course, under the first past the post system, they're going to be finding it very difficult to get up a foothold.
Well, no, the most important thing is that there's little or no media coverage. It would be lovely, absolutely wonderful to see George Galloway taking on Sunak and Starmer in some sort of TV debate. But of course, the collaborators at ITV and the BBC are very unlikely to allow that. Let's just hope something like that does happen, because then we will have actually some real use for the mass media, the London media. But I spoke this week to Peter Ford, who's the deputy leader of the Workers' Party of Britain under George Galloway, and he had this to say about their election tactics.
The Rochdale factor. I'm being a bit facetious, but I think one of the factors is that Sunak has reckoned that it's the Gaza factor is going to work for him, in that it will undermine Labour, and the Workers' Party and many independent candidates are going to make inroads into the Labour vote. Whereas if he hangs on for 6 months, well, probably Gaza will be receding in the rearview mirror, and the Workers' Party and others will do less well. And so it made sense from that point of view to go early. Of course, economic factors are also in play. He's just had some relatively good news on the inflation front. Things are not going to get better. But I do think that the Gaza factor has been a consideration, and it will affect at least 50 constituencies where Labour either have vulnerable sitting MPs, including people like Angela Rayner in Ashton-under-Lyne, and a number in marginal constituencies where Labour were counting on winning.
So there's Peter Ford, Deputy Leader of the Workers' Party of Britain, former British Ambassador to Syria, speaking to me earlier this week. Martin, it sounds like there could be a few surprises as the Workers' Party up north particularly targets some of these marginal seats like Angela Rayner's.
Well, it may well be the case. I mean, a first-past-the-post election is a bit of a lottery, and people will make up their minds in which constituency they are in, what they are prepared to do in order to get what they want. People are getting more sophisticated at tactical voting. But all that will happen if they do well is we may, I mean, of course, if this was South Africa, Starmer wouldn't get a majority because it would be a proportional system and he would have to talk to other people. But of course, if he's lucky, he will get an overall majority and he won't have to talk to anybody and the system will just trundle on and we will just get more pro-US, pro-Israel policies, which will become increasingly unsustainable because they're going to war with the world and we don't really need to be on their side.
No, we certainly don't. And guy I interviewed last week, Nicholas Jones, former BBC industrial correspondent, I don't know if people listening now had listened to the longer interview, which I put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk last week, but he had some fascinating things to say about the Labour Party on Brexit. He seems to be hinting, it's interesting, I mean, he's a bit of an insider, really. He still talks to a lot of people who are close to the Labour Party, that maybe there will be an attempt to rejoin the EU after Labour get in. But the thing is that they can't say anything about it, and this is why.
I think the fear is on the Labour side. They just fear the power of the Conservative press in this country, because although we were talking about it and talked about how the national newspapers just sell a mere fraction, 3 million copies today, but the power of the Conservative machine is supported by the Conservative press. All the columnists and commentators, so many of them appear on social media, on sympathetic these new radio channels. If you turn on the telly, one test and see a sort of, you know, the panels that are set up, the predominance is to have talking heads from the right. The left is very badly underrepresented because if you take, for example, Labour think tanks, they're just a mere shadow of what they used to be because, of course, they've lacked the funding. The trade unions haven't got the members. The trade unions aren't supporting left-wing publications. So the number of left-wing commentators and journalists and think tank people is a fraction of what it used to be in the 70s and 80s. And that's because, you know, partly because of the decline of the left and especially the left in the trade union and labour movement. And the Conservatives, I think, know that immigration is that fear factor story. And, of course, it's inextricably linked to Brexit. How was the referendum won? I think it was won on the fear factor. Farage and Boris Johnson and everybody else put across this line that you've got to vote for Brexit because if you don't, we're going to be flooded with immigrants. I mean, we saw the stories time and time again. They exploited the fear factor of immigration for political purposes. And I think Labour fear that if they start talking about things like Brexit and immigration and get too deeply involved, the Tory commentators, there'll be a sort of cascade coming down from the Conservative newspapers, and it'll be followed through, as I said, in all of the talk shows, on all of the social media platforms. We have to recognise that the right in this country dominates many of these platforms. And, you know, it's a tragedy, but that is the reality of it. I mean, there aren't as many journalists, think tank people on the left as there should be. as I think they should be. And that's a tragedy, and that's what Labour fear, and that's why they won't tackle an issue like Brexit until they get into power, because they know that if they dare put a foot in the water, it can be used against them by the Conservative machine.
So do you think maybe when Starmer gets in, we will rejoin the EU?
Well, I think there's no doubt we'll have a much more positive relationship with the EU. How far it will go is open to question. But at the moment, it's a sort of red line. Labour just dare not talk about it because they fear that it would just be used against them. I mean, you've only got to look at Reform and GB News, all of these platforms which are in the... And look, some of them are in the ascendancy. You know, it's a worrying time for the left because they know that they could really be damaged. We saw it in the 2019 general election. We saw it in the Brexit referendum. That, my word, that can turn people out if you frighten them enough. And they were certainly frightened. And many people still are frightened over immigration. You know, you've only got to go to places in the West Country where there isn't where you don't have large numbers of people moving in, but people there are very, very concerned about immigration. So it's one of those issues which, unfortunately, can be exploited by politicians.
So that's former BBC industrial correspondent Nicholas Jones. He used to write quite regularly for Free Press, the magazine of the Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom, which sadly shut down a few years ago. And the conclusion there, Martin, is perhaps there are certain things which are going to, policies which are going to be popping up after a general election, which, you know, he's saying, well, just don't talk about this stuff because actually the press will tear you to pieces if you do.
I think the Labour Party leadership have decided that they are not going to, they definitely won't be going back into the European Union after the next election. They've said that clearly. They're not going to do that. But of course, we are effectively in the single market because the Tory government has agreed, and there's nothing else they could agree, that we're going to fulfil all of the regulations of the single market, and we're not going to have British kite marks. We're not going back to feet and inches and all the rest of it. And that's because it's just nonsense to do that. But of course, we're in the single market, as is everybody else in Europe, including Iceland, Switzerland, and all these hanger-on countries like Albania. We're all in it because we've all got to use the same rules and regs. So in other words, we were never going to be able to have our own rules and regulations. That's just not on in the modern world. Business is not going to have two sets of regulations to work to. They've got to work to single market regulations. They're not prepared to have a second set of British regulations. So all that stuff about how we were going to do something different from the single market is wrong. The single market isn't going away. The European Union itself may collapse. It may become a political dinosaur.
Yeah, especially if Ursula von der Leyen also gets prosecuted for war crimes, there could be all sorts of problems. Anyway, I don't want to dwell on these what's going to happen afterwards because we just really don't know. And it's interesting that Nicholas Jones says that you've got various topics like this they may have made a strategic decision. It may be a sensible one not to mention anything about it at all because the right-wing press, and it is, of course, a right-wing press generally, will tear them to shreds. In a way, Martin, you know, the failure of Sunak just means that, like Sooty and Sweep at the beginning of this programme, when they're interviewed by one of these news anchors, that the best thing to say is nothing, because the Sunak is actually destroying his own credibility on his own, and people are more likely to vote for somebody, or they'll vote for anybody. There's no vision. There's just somebody else to vote for who's not that awful guy over there.
Yes, and of course that's a defensive strategy. You know, Arsenal as a football team made a great deal of success out of that sort of strategy over many years, and of course Starmer is an Arsenal fan. That can work because you know we just not, I mean, don't forget the other thing that forces this into a very narrow field is the first past the post system. They need to get ex-Tory voters who voted for Brexit to vote Labour. Now, if it was a proportional system, they wouldn't have to worry about those people so much. But they are vital. But elections in Britain are decided by of relatively small, less than a million people who live in the satellite towns around London.
Well, it's actually quite... Which way they vote. It's a very complicated, you know, especially when you've got lots of minor parties. So we shall see. Anyway, we're going to be speaking, we hope, live to Charlie Skelton in Lisbon at this year's Bilderberg Conference. But before that, I've got what I think I would like to call a bit of a scoop, really, which is an interview, the first one I've done, actually, with a former BBC reporter called Duncan Campbell. He became famous, or even infamous, in the 1970s as part of the and 80s as this as a journalist working for Time Out magazine, I think it was. And in Time Out, he was looking into GCHQ. He was arrested, and various others were. And this famous ABC trial ensued. Can you just say something a little bit about that? I mean, Duncan talks about it in the longer version of this interview, but what was the ABC trial, Martin?
Well, you're going back to my very, very youth now. It was because I think it was some CIA people come over here and were briefing Campbell and others about the iniquities of the CIA, and the Labour government at the time tried to squash the whole debate and tried to, I think ABC were all, I can't remember the names of them, but they were
Crispin Aubrey was the first one. You know, I'm sure we can look it up by the end of hearing this. But anyway, I asked Duncan about what is these deadly serious issue right now, which is the destruction of these three Russian early warning radars. Martin, you know, just before we hear from him, this is pretty damn serious, isn't it? Because the Russians are saying this has got nothing to do with the Ukraine war. These are NATO targets hit by NATO soldiers using NATO weapons.
Yes. And they're also making the Russians think that there's a potential for a first strike on Russia. How insane is that? And, of course, we're not discussing anything about this in the election campaign.
No.
Because we all
know
that Zelensky's a hero and Putin's a monster, and there's nothing to talk about.
So Duncan Campbell's programme was called Secret Society, that caused so much consternation in the 1986, I think it was. And it helped to get Alistair Milne, who was Seamus Milne's father, Seamus Milne was Jeremy Corbyn's press secretary, sacked as director general of the BBC and replaced by the accountant. And that really was the end of the BBC. That decision was made by Margaret Thatcher and by Marmaduke Hussey, the chairman of the BBC, but it was actually Victor Rothschild who famously said to Marmaduke Hussey, can you sack the director general? And the director general was duly sacked. So let's have a listen to what Duncan's got to say about this latest horrendous idea that NATO is quietly using the proxy of Zelensky in Ukraine, taking out these big Russian ballistic missile, nuclear missile defence systems.
We're into a very disturbing period in which the fog of war and the uncertainty of what is actually going on in the military in all sides should be a matter of enormous worry and concern, but remarkably isn't. But that's almost something that we foresaw in the 1980s. So the specific thing you're asking me about is the destruction, I think, about 2 weeks ago, of two Russian radar facilities, three radars, two facilities is what I've seen on the report. This does not appear to be disinformation. It's backed up by satellite imagery of the damage. It's being reported by Yahoo and elsewhere. And since nobody has issued any statements about this, everybody is speculating, one, that this is an attack by Ukraine, but using Western-supplied assets. It's been suggested that the cruise missiles that would have been used were British-supplied ones called Storm Shadow, but I've also seen suggestions that it was a Portuguese-supplying turboprop type of cruise missile. The damage to the Russian stations is clear. I would say it's substantial. And I would suspect, in the case of at least two of the three radars that I've seen, that they're out of action for the time being. Now, the points about what these are defending against and why attacked is very, very curious. However, what is much, much more alarming is when you look at the number of other things that have been happening this week and right up to this morning and, in fact, at this minute. And I find myself for the first time to compare the international patterns of activities to very familiar scenarios of what it would look like if we were building up to nuclear war. The other events that I've noticed are, there's a report in the newspapers today, most of the British newspapers, about patterns of sabotage attacks across Western Europe. One was a fire in the UK for which persons have already been arrested and accused of working for Russia. There's suspicion about a massive fire in Poland and several other incidents of that kind. What's not been noticed, but I've noticed from those who watch the things, is that Russian trawlers have been, deep-level trawlers, have been trawling back and forth across the lines of important cables. And you can, they're allowing their transponders to be visible so that you could, this can be seen to be done. So you know it's signaling a threat as opposed to an actual attack. No report that those cables have been damaged. There's no question that that's extremely aggressive activity. Another aggressive activity coming from the West has just started. So this week, two, and I think it's now four, of the American Air Force B-52 bombers flew over to the UK. And this morning they took off and they are flying circles with loads of cruise missiles going all the way around the Russian strategic enclave of Kaliningrad. Kaliningrad isn't joined to Russia itself, so they can encircle them. And Kaliningrad is the location where Putin says, whether he's done it in fact or not is open to doubt, but Putin says he has deployed tactical nuclear weapons to, in anticipation of a potential attack. So there is a secret dialogue going on of increasing tension, covert attacks. If this attack on the Russian radars is Ukraine-derived, it is hard to explain how it benefits Ukraine. The radars concerned, in my opinion, from the study of the satellite images, are pretty much exactly the same as we have in Britain at Fylingdales in the North York Moor. So it's a large concrete-style block building which contains different types of antenna that can be pointed around, and it will attack, spot missiles or aircraft at long range. I don't agree with some reports that it can look over the horizon. It's not that kind of radar. But it's very much the Russian equivalent of Fylingdales parked on there. Boundaries, looking out, looking across the Earth's horizon to see something that's coming. But where it looks, where these radars look, essentially are not looking into the battlefield areas that the Russians have chosen to create in the east of Ukraine. Therefore, it's extremely questionable as to whether why there would be a military advantage to Ukraine in attacking these sites as opposed to others. They've attacked lots of other Russian radar stations. So you draw back and you say that is unprecedented. That is beyond any doubt a Russian strategic defense asset. And it's, on the face of it, appears to be being taken out. The very fact that nobody is saying anything about this, not the Russians, not the Ukraine, not the Americans, is itself rather worrying because the damage is clear. So I'm just finding myself drawn to back to, horrifically, to the mid-1980s when we had all these nuclear war scenarios. And then there would be exercises. Some of your listeners may remember in 1982, 40 years ago, there was an exercise called Able Archer at a time when the cruise missiles and Pershing missiles were being deployed to Europe. And we now know that we came awfully close to nuclear war because the Russians misled the Western level of aggression. looking at the number of apparently unrelated events, there is a covert war building up. How and why the Ukraine attacked these radars, if they did, is a mystery which we may know about. In the future, we may not. But it is quite clear that with trawlers maneuvering over cables, and finally, we are in the time of a massive, biggest ever for three decades, NATO exercise called Steadfast Defender, I think. And again, highly aggressive activities are being very, very loudly conducted, such as a helicopter attack from Finland across the Baltic. Now, it was a simulated attack, so the target was another NATO country playing defender. But you don't need to be at Russian military school to figure out that what's being threatened again is Kaliningrad.
Martin, that's Duncan Campbell, investigative journalist, speaking to me yesterday about these series of attacks on the three now on the Russian early warning defence radars. Britain actually has only got one of these radars in Fylingdales in North Yorkshire. And in a way, the most fascinating part of this, apart from a brilliant job Duncan did there in compiling all the different aspects to this strategic attack on Russia and the so-called Russian arson sabotage campaign, which has been launched in Europe this week, it's all ramping up, but no one really saying much about it.
Well, it depends if you're following it or not. I'm following it closely.
Well, no, what I'm saying is the interesting thing is that there's been very little actual coverage, little bits here and there. Certainly nobody is putting two and two together, very, very few people. And that says a lot, in a way, for the Russians. So they're thinking, now, if we're going to hit Fylingdales, we certainly don't want to give them any warning.
No, well, I'm not quite sure what the Russians are going to do. But when Cameron the other week said it was okay of British Storm Shadow missiles to be used to fire into Russia proper, and then he was happy and okay with it. The British ambassador was called in and told in no uncertain terms, because, of course, British military personnel are firing these things. Ukrainians don't know how to use them. Now, obviously, one of the things that the Russians could do is just whack back at the people that are shooting at them. But, of course, they move them around, so it's quite difficult to locate them. But what they've said is, if you attack, you know, for example, if there's an attack on a military base outside Moscow by one of these Storm Shadow missiles, the Russians have said, well, we're going to attack on a military base outside London. Which one should we go for? We're not going to tell you. And, of course, what I would do if I was the Russians, I wouldn't go for I would go for a military base and kill as many British soldiers as possible in the run-up to the election, if they dare to fire these missiles.
In a way, you can see what's going on in the evil minds of these NATO hawks trying to get a nuclear war started, or at least pretending they are, the maniacs that they are, is, well, actually, with the Russian hypersonic missile technology, a lot of these Fylingdales-type places are kind of redundant. And so, well, we may as well, we don't care if they take ours out, because we know that, that it won't be able to stop the hypersonic nukes coming over if Russians decide they want to send them. So why don't we just take theirs out? You can almost see the officers' mess, barrack room chit-chat that's led to this happening.
Well, what you've got is a delusionary British Army leadership, in my view.
Is this really British? Surely it's the Americans behind this. Well, NATO.
The Americans, we are the Americans' glove puppets, but the British like to think of themselves as very important. They see themselves as going ahead of the Americans and being even more belligerent to the Russians than the Americans dare to do, which is why Cameron spoke out of turn and said British missiles, it's okay for them to be used. The Americans have now said the same. So the Russians are bracing for this attack. Once this attack comes in, they won't do anything until it comes in, because they've told them don't do it. If you do it, we will react. So don't imagine that we won't react. But I imagine what the Russians are hoping is that common sense will prevail at the top. Military professionals will just say this is nuts, because we won't be able to do much damage with this to Russian infrastructure. But when they fire back, because their missiles are superior.
One does wonder, what the Commander-in-Chief, King Charles, is thinking and getting involved in all this when there's no government really to be bothered with. And what about Biden? Yeah, you mentioned him, but before we hear from what's going on with Biden saying, yeah, fine, just go and hit targets in Russia, what they're not saying is whether they're strategic targets or whether they're targets which are linked to Ukraine. So I think we need to be really clear in our mind. Some targets are NATO targets and other targets are Ukrainian targets. So ones involved in the Ukraine war are Ukrainian targets. The ones that may be about a World War III, are NATO targets. And that's why this is also concerning, is these are now what we're seeing being taken out by the Ukrainian proxies and almost certainly by British, US and other NATO soldiers actually firing these weapons from Ukraine. But anyway, Duncan Campbell did mention this. Do you remember anything about this, Martin, this exercise Able Archer back in the 1980s? Yes.
Well, what happened there was, because of the ramping up of tension by putting Pershing missiles into West Germany, as it then was, which had a six-minute fire time to Moscow, so they're basically a classic decapitation strike missile, and the cruise missiles, which at the time the Russians were unable to stop because they came in under the radar, and they really believed that the West was preparing his first strike on them. That was their assessment.
Well, maybe they were right.
Well, yeah, yes, when Duncan Campbell said that the Russians misperceived that, that wasn't the case. They didn't misperceive it. But what actually happened was a flock of swans was picked up by one of these long-range radar things, and they thought it was an incoming strike. And they were just about to fire back, and the guy who was in charge of it was about to press the button, and he decided not to. And they checked it, and it turned out to be swans. But, of course, he was actually disobeying his orders there. He should have pressed the button, but he chose not to.
You know, it's funny, isn't it? I'm reminded, Martin, I'm reminded of the John Pilger documentary, The Coming War on China, where he talks about a very similar thing during the Cuban Missile Crisis, where I think it was in the Philippines, a nuclear missile battery, or maybe one of the Indian Ocean Islands, somewhere, Pilger takes the cameras and he talks to people who were there at the time, and they said, we got orders to nuke China. And some of the people said, well, we can't do this. That China's not even involved in the Cuban Missile Crisis. And so, luckily, the human factor stopped the whole thing turning into some kind of nuclear war. But it just shows you what maniacs there are out there. And Duncan Campbell, in the second shorter clip, talks a little bit about this ridiculous Able Archer exercise and how it nearly led to a nuclear war in 1982.
If Putin goes further, it'll mean commitment of NATO forces, and we'll all be living in our fingernails as to whether we get to see the end of the decade. So that is the scale of the worry that now seems to be escalating in the background. And this is how it's always been feared that things would start. But things have got started and then gone, been okay in the past, but thinking about the events now going on and reaching into the past, probably the best analogy is to the 1980s and to when a very aggressive NATO exercise called Able Archer started, and it was a rehearsal of a major nuclear attack on the Soviet Union to take out their command centers. And the world may, in fact, have been saved by a spy inside the Soviet Union who realized that the leadership were overreacting to what the West was doing, and the West was not realizing how much risk they were taking. And the word was passed through the intelligence agencies. And I think it's right to say historically the exercise was scaled down precisely because if the Russians really thought it was a run-up to wars apart from an aggressive exercise, that was not what was planned. And the posturing going on here, if in fact NATO countries, Britain, Portugal, whoever, have authorized what we all presume to be a Ukrainian strike on these missiles that are not actually apparently consequential for the fight to free Ukraine territory, and Russian trawlers are out in the Atlantic threatening damage. American bombers have just come to Britain, and yesterday they were flying circles and literally orbiting just, I've just looked at their tracks. I learned they were orbiting to the east of the Russian territory for a very considerable period. However, the very fact that you can see the tracks, using civil society tools rather than secret intelligence satellites means that this is being done secretly in the open.
So that's investigative journalist Duncan Campbell, former BBC reporter and journalist for the Secret Society series back in the 1980s, author of The Unsinkable Aircraft Carrier and the amazing book War Plan UK, which I talked to him about, and which describes what would happen if there was a world war broke out in Europe. And it would be quite frightening. Actually, quite a lot of Americans would suddenly turn up and start commandeering and taking over various parts of the UK, speaking to me earlier this week. And in the backdrop to all of this, of course, we've got the Bilderberg Conference going on this week. And I hope I'm joined on the line now by Charlie Skelton over in Madrid. Are you there, Charlie?
I hope so.
I
think I'm here.
Yes, okay, right. Can you just give us a bit of a flavour of the participants and the venue this year?
Certainly. Well, the venue's not as luxurious as they usually are. It's, if anything, it is more secure and more private than I in my sadly long experience has ever seen. I mean, people are getting almost no photographs. Everyone's being kept very, very carefully away. The participant list has come out. They have at least published that and a kind of slightly thin agenda. We are now sort of just, you know, here covering it as best we can, you know, this raggle-taggle crew.
Yeah, well, the problem is, surely, that if it's difficult to get photographs, there may be people sneaking in and out, as we've had in previous years, like the main negotiator for the Swedes joining NATO was at last year's meeting in Lisbon, and he wasn't on the list. So this may be the case this year. I mean, who have you spotted, or have people spotted?
Well, Josh Friedman got a photograph of the King of Spain coming in. And which, you know, it's one of those things where we would never have been able to report on it. But he happened, you know, the light fell in just the right way on the tinted window. And he got a great photo. And, you know, and I'm not saying that the King of Spain participated in the meetings, but he was, you know, he certainly went there to Gladham and you know.
Is he on the list? Is he on the list, though?
No, he's not on the list.
No, this is it. This is the point, isn't it? How can you have the King of Spain being there and not on the list?
I know. But they would say, and I know this from long and tired experience, that he's not participating in the conference itself. He's just visiting the hotel.
No, he's...
But the conference itself is more than just a series of, you know, debates. It's the whole experience of meeting people and
schmoozing,
you know, and in the most, you know, the high level way, and, you know, climbing up the greasy pole and all of that, and, you know, sort of getting the nod for top jobs and that kind of thing, which, you know, that is a key part of it. The King of Spain has at least paid a visit, that much we know.
What about the backdrop to all of this with the agenda? We know a lot about, in fact, you've got two things to do with AI right at the very start. It seems to me almost the star of the show is Alex Karp from Palantir.
Yeah.
He's now kind of at the forefront of this whole concept of, oh dear, we can't get human beings to kill each other. So what we can do is we can get Alex Karp's software to identify them and wipe them out. And in a way, he's the man who will allow computers to take over warfare. And obviously, can you just say something about this idea of software and warfare? Because this is very much a kind of NATO-oriented group, isn't it?
Totally, and well, Karp's very interesting because he's one of the obviously now this is the first Bilderberg, I should say, without Henry Kissinger for a long time. Yeah. He couldn't make it because he passed over into whatever realm he now inhabits or rules, and he was obviously one of the great ideologues of Bilderberg, and you know, see. Into that vacuum, who's going to step? Let's see. I mean, it could be Karp, who's extremely outspoken and talks, you know, openly about his kind of philosophy of life, philosophy of business, etc., etc. You know, Schmidt does the same, the former head of Google. He's always talking, you know, and he was, you know, Kissinger's right-hand man and protege. And you've also got Peter Thiel, and he talks, you know, theorizes quite a lot about the world. And they form a little kind of tech billionaire clutch within Bilderberg, and I think they're probably the most powerful kind of clique within this powerful clique.
Yeah, well, so Kissinger not being around, Charlie, is quite... I think it's in a way quite worrying. Some of his last words were about... You're going to have to basically have a peace in Ukraine, draw a line, and have an armistice of some sort. And he was roundly wrapped, had his knuckles wrapped for that. But he's an old hand at all this. He knows you can play your geostrategic games, but you mustn't be trying to provoke superpower confrontations, nuclear confrontations. And he's now out of the picture. So I wonder what you think. This new little clutch, as you put it, where are they coming from?
Well, they're all pretty psychotic, I suppose. I mean, Karp is very. He calls himself a progressive. He calls himself a peace activist and a progressive. But his main aim in life at the moment is just to super efficiently kill people and surveil them. And sometimes both. And so anyway, I don't think many of them, and Schmidt maybe a bit, have got the kind of, you know, it's hard to say nice things about Henry Kissinger, but as you say, some kind of a calmer perspective on things. I think maybe he had a calmer perspective because he was in his late 90s and didn't have his hand on the nuclear button anymore, so I don't know.
I don't think Kissinger ever wanted to provoke a nuclear war. He wanted to provoke any other war, but not a nuclear one.
No, right. So Karp is, you know, his sort of statement of intent is to say, he says, look, we just need to throw as much money at tech defence. And build weapons that will, and he literally says, scare the F-U-C-K out of your enemies. You know, he just wants to dominate and destroy, and build the machines that will do that. And there's another very interesting guy there this year who is the guy who designed the Oculus VR. Headset. He's called I think he's called Palmer Luckey, something like that. So he's another tech billionaire who's a you know, a generation younger, and he got bored of making, you know, gaming headsets and wanted to make autonomous tanks instead and autonomous flying vehicles. And so yeah, there's a lot of people and who are big on AI autonomous weaponry and, you know, automated warfare. And I think David Petraeus has started to say, because he's got a book out, so the former CIA director and Bilderberg regular, he has got a book out on warfare, I think, at the moment, and he's sort of talking it up. And talking about, you know, drones being the future, and Eric Schmidt said the future of warfare is drones, and literally one of the sessions is called the future of warfare. And so, you know, I think that, you know, they're sort of coldly pragmatic, this crowd. They just go, yeah, okay, what's next? What's the next thing? Let's do that. Let's just, okay, so it's AI-powered drones. Fine, let's just build the best one of those. You know, well, what's the best system we can get that can just target people and snipe them from a drone? You know, and...
But it's a sort of...
Gaza or Ukraine, you know.
Yeah, it's almost a self-fulfilling prophecy, this, isn't it? It's a bunch of people who are trying to sell their technology to a bunch of financial people who want to it's something good to invest in. So it's almost as if the whole politics of it is out the window. It's almost just like a kind of investment party. But the trouble is that these people have now lobbied so successfully and so hard, they're pretty much in control of most of the policy and the politics in Western Europe. And the state.
Well, you've said the key word, I think, which is in control. And I think what scares them about AI, because obviously it's a huge boom for whether it's surveillance tech or banking or healthcare or anything, you know, literally everything is now infused with AI and is getting more so. But one of the sessions this year is on... AI safety is one of the two AI sessions. And they know it's a problem because they're building this thing and they're all in on it, as in their chips all in, is what I mean. And they're building this thing which they kind of know they can't control. And there's an interesting video of Demis Hassabis, who's the CEO of Google DeepMind, and he's a Bilderberg regular, he's here this year in Madrid, talking very recently about how he thinks that, yes, AI, or, you know, he's talking about AGI, artificial general intelligence, is going to create, he calls it a bottleneck for humanity, but he says he's optimistic that they can navigate through this and build the right architecture so that he can, you know, and then he becomes an tech evangelist. You know, he says literally, you know, a radical new era of abundance and curing all diseases taking our consciousness to the stars. And if you listen to what he's saying, that's religious language. I mean, it's apocalyptic language, and it's you know, he's describing some kind of, you know, as it were, post-human state that would have been described as heaven in years gone by. And, you know, he doesn't know he's doing that, by the way, I don't think. I think he's just describing a cool state of affairs. But not everyone shares his optimism. And I think Bilderberg, because there are so many people there that own so much and control so much, that I think they see AI with a slightly, you know, fearful eye, because what is this thing? They've suddenly realised there's going to be stuff happening that not only they don't control and understand, but no one does. Only AI does. So, you know, it's going to start talking to itself and to other AIs in, you know, in ways that we can't comprehend. Performing, it already does this. It already performs tasks that humans can't comprehend, etc., etc. So, you know, they know they're building the beast in some, you know, form. And I think they're sort of both thrilled and scared, like everyone is in a horror movie, that, you know, that this world happens to now be.
Well, hopefully not everywhere, but certainly places like Ukraine and Gaza certainly seem to be going that way. AI safety, I suppose, really, what you're saying is that they're worried that some of these killing machines that they are building might come for them.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's all, you know, the paperclip problem, you know, it's telling AI to do something and it's misunderstanding the question and accidentally destroying the solar system, and etc., etc. But it's interesting, you know, when Demis Hassabis says take consciousness to the stars, it's not clear that he means human consciousness. I think he just sort of means some kind of hybridized AI, basically AI, but some sort of thing that some sort of consciousness is going to expand and start. But I think he's, you know, I think he just sort of thinks that, I think he thinks confusedly that human consciousness and AI consciousness are sort of the same thing. And, you know, he should know better because he's one of the world experts in this.
Well, maybe he's just been watching too much Star Trek and dropping too much acid at the same time, you know. That's not really the best way to pop for policy. But the scary thing is, he's there and he's with all these financial people saying, hey, guys, this is the future. Look, what about the crew that's over there? I mean, I'm so sorry I couldn't come. This year, too expensive for me this year. Some years I can manage it, some I can't. It's accommodation in Madrid is extremely, well, I don't know how you manage it really, but can you give us an idea about the crew? You've got a bunch of loyal people that do really dedicate themselves to this once a year, haven't you?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's great that anyone turns up, but I would have hoped that it would be a slightly bigger crew by now, but you know, it's still, you know, there's been on and off about somewhere between, you know, 8 and 12 people, you know, which is not, and unfortunately we've lost 2 of them today because 2 Dutch journalists who were here, really nice people, just really interested in, you know, geopolitics, very polite, just wanted to do some filming. A bunch of extremely heavy-handed undercover cops got round them in the cafe, really shouted at them, and really upset them, and they just left Madrid. So we're 2 down, and I haven't experienced that, I have to say, with the police here, but they really lost it with them. And I don't know why, but it's already thinned out. Giorgio Bombassei has gone home, unfortunately. He had other matters to attend to. But Dan Dix is here, Josh Friedman's here, and Federico's here. There's people you know, and we've been retweeting each other and sharing images and what little tidbits that we do get. And, we're doing what we can. Yeah, it's far from easy. You know, they don't make it... And I have to say, they made it harder this year. It's tight as a drum, the security here.
So, just to talk a little bit about some of the UK participants, we've got BP. And in fact, I've started not talking about the names, but the businesses that they really represent. Because it's almost as if, you know, with, you know, that film, The Corporation, the Canadian film, that these are immortal creatures, these corporations, and it really doesn't matter who's popping up as the chief. It's the corporation that really counts. So, you know, BP, Shell, and, of course, the press. Bloomberg is there. I mean, I don't know if they're British or Tory, but I think the guy is a Brit that runs Bloomberg now, Micklethwaite. Yeah. Then you've got the editor of the Economist. This is a sort of energy media thing, isn't it? But it's not, and it's not just. Sorry,
there's a lot of journalists there this year. Yeah, it's something. One of the before they left, the Dutch journalist gave me an interesting tidbit. So they pointed out that there are 2 journalists from the Dutch newspaper NRC. And or a media group, and that is owned by, they pointed out, a media group that is run by Thomas Leysen, who is a Belgian industrialist, and he's on the board of Bilderberg. So there's 2 sort of pet journalists here from this particular Dutch media organization. But he also pointed out that one of the other Dutch attendees, who is the main shareholder of Heineken. So she's actually Freddie Heineken's daughter. She's Charlene de Carvalho. Her actual name is Charlene de Carvalho Heineken, but she decided to leave Heineken off the participant list. I guess she felt embarrassed. But anyway, her father, Freddie Heineken, was best friends with Bernhard. So And Bernhard's grandson, the King of Holland, is here. So I wonder whether she's there perhaps for the 70th, the 70-year anniversary, because it was 70 years just on the day before the... 70 years since the first conference kicked off and the day before this conference did. So anyway, going back to the journalists, yes, they are... technically they're journalists, but, they're such sort of travesties of journalists. At least the financiers and asset managers and bank bosses aren't doing anything kind of... They're just doing what you would expect of them. Whereas journalists, you sort of go, oh, really? Is this what you thought being a journalist was going to be? Not reporting on something? It's like it's a complete antithesis of journalism. And yet they all go, if I'm going to sit here and get the pearls of wisdom and share our perspectives and then go away and kind of, internalise our consensus or whatever, however exactly it works. But yes, it always really depresses me to see the journalists.
Yeah, it is.
But also, particularly when it's so blinking hard for the journalists who are outside and so tough and so unforgiving. And, and they're clinking champagne glasses or, It's slightly galling.
Collaborators.
Exactly. Shoot them.
Yeah. Well, there is this guy, I think it's a guy, Christopher Cavoli, Supreme Allied Commander Europe.
Yes.
Also, of course, you've got Stoltenberg from NATO. This week, Charlie, there's been all this. We've just been reporting on the attacks on the Russian strategic nuclear defense systems. There's also this report yesterday circulating around Europe about Russia has started a massive campaign of sabotage, setting fire to things, etc., around Europe. And also the American B-52 bombers, presumably nuclear armed, circling around Kaliningrad. So there seems to be an upping of the ante, and it seems to be very much less to do with fighting for the east of Ukraine or trying to make a peace there at all, but much more about a NATO versus Russia war. So it's a little bit concerning about having all these people hobnobbing with all the financial people who will stand through the good old disaster capitalism to make an absolute fortune on any war.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it was very concerning to see the session title of their Ukraine section here at Bilderberg, which is Ukraine and the World. It's not just Ukraine, it's Ukraine and the world. There's a real unpleasant whiff of World War about that phrase. And, the perspective suddenly has got wider, as you say. And yes, so, and with Stoltenberg here, he attends pretty much every Bilderberg, and Christopher Cavoli, he's been a few times now. And so he's like the number two, I think, military leader in NATO, and very, very, very senior. And as the name Supreme Allied Commander Europe does suggest. And so Stoltenberg's here. He's about to leave the Secretary General position at NATO. And his successor is thought to be Mark Rutte, the Dutch Prime Minister. I think he's got almost all of the nominations in the bag. I think it's about 3 outstanding votes, but it looks like he's going to get it. So it's very, it's very much an inside man for Bilderberg, because Rutte's always going along. He's definitely one of the team, even though he's not on the steering committee. So Stoltenberg will be, I'm sure, addressing everyone. And who knows? I mean, to be honest, Stoltenberg's leaving just the right time. It's whatever's about to happen isn't going to happen on his watch.
I know you try and tease a little bit of comedy out of all of this, and of course there is a massive aspect of absurdity to these people's thinking that they can just carry on in the way they do, controlling politics, and no one will be interested, undermining democracy. But if, have you managed to actually find anything comic about this year's event, Charlie?
Gosh. I've written the piece for The Guardian. It's not gone up yet, so, I mean, no, touch wood, it will. And I don't really put that many jokes in anymore. I used to write, like, really quite stupid, not stupid, but quite silly pieces about Bilderberg, but now it's got more and more serious and more newsy, what I write. But I did make one joke about Henry Kissinger not being here, which I thought was funny. I hope they don't cut it, but we'll see. Because sometimes they just cut the jokes out. Because, you know, I have to say, I'm not saying, oh my God, I'm censored by the media. I'm really not. Except they sometimes cut my jokes out because I just think they find them annoying.
Look, the thing is, the whole thing is that there is an air of absurdity, though, isn't there? Don't you think, about the idea that these people think they can carry on in this fashion, where actually what they're doing is they're undermining everything that the West is supposed to be about, the whole sort of democratic checks and balances, and also normally there are British MPs there. We haven't really, I mean, unless any of them get spotted by Josh in his eagle telephoto lens. Is it just, you think, the general election that's meant that they're not really interested in these British participants?
Definitely, they always have a kind of, people sort of step away when they get too involved in politics generally. So, for example, Radoslaw Sikorski, who is the now Polish minister, foreign minister. So he was on the steering committee when he was just, I think he was an MEP, but then he's too senior now. He stepped away from the steering committee. And that happened as well with the current head of the CIA, who he just joined, so William Burns, he just joined the Bilderberg steering committee, then got offered the job of head of CIA, so immediately left again. So it's like, and I think it's a smaller version of that with the British, the UK election. I think that they just, it's just too much to do it now. So much as I'm sure David Lammy particularly would love to be here in his run up to being foreign secretary.
Yeah, if they let him in.
Exactly. There was a, for those of you who don't know, that's a reference to David Lammy not managing to somehow not get into the conference last year. Following Ed Ball's efforts, I remember.
Yes, that's right, a few years before. Yeah. Okay, well, anyway, look, let's just wind up by mentioning a certain Mr. John Saws, the executive chair of New Bridge Advisory Group, but he's being a bit cheeky, isn't he, by not mentioning his other job?
Yes. Yeah, he's a director of BP. And, it's weird that he wants to be called that, because that's just his private company that he just does his... it's just him. I think maybe his wife's the director.
Yes, for tax. Tax avoidance.
It's just tax. So... It's slightly embarrassing, but you know, there's other versions of that on here. So one of them, sometimes they just don't put what they really are. So the one who's she's got an executive job at Coca-Cola here. So I can't remember. Oh yeah, she's a Spanish delegate, and she's the chair of some Euro Pacific Coca-Cola subsidiary, but actually she's a director of Banco Santander, which is the host company for this week's conference, and Anna Batan is the executive chairman of that. So you know, that's not really what she is here. What she is here is a director of the bank that's hosting Bilderberg. You often have to dig a little bit into what people say.
Yeah, they're cheeky. They're very cheeky, and they do take the mickey. So Soares, also former MI6 Director General, as well as BP. So that seems to be what's going on. We've got intelligence services, we've got massive energy companies appointing each other, but actually they're not even writing that down here. So if anyone just happens to take a cursory look, then... Anyway, look, so Charlie, can you just tell us where you are? You're obviously in some nice bar. Are you having dinner there?
Well, I will be. I'm sorry.
It's nice. Very good atmosphere. It sounds very congenial. Yes.
Yeah, it's very good. They're very nice. They've offered us a table for the Champions League final, but unfortunately, I just don't care. So I don't think I'll do that. But maybe I need to just muster up caring about it for the course of an evening. I'll probably have a better time.
Maybe, as a bit of a distraction. Anyway, look, could you just wind up by letting us know whereabouts good places might be for people to actually follow what's going on, since the mainstream press, as usual, is ignoring everything? The most important thing in the world really going on now. Our real political leaders are sort of Fourth Reich get-together of accelerationists, and yet no one seems to be interested in the future. But anyway, so, yeah, whereabouts might be good places to follow what's happening?
Well, to be honest, I would say just hashtag Bilderberg. Put that into Twitter. Bilderberg Madrid, Bilderberg 2024, and have a look around Twitter, because that's everyone seen, or sorry, x.com. Everyone seems to be putting their stuff out there. And you'll find, you know, Dan and Josh and Federico and Christina, a Spanish journalist who's here. You'll soon pick up on who's doing what.
And what's the chat from the people that you are coming out of the conference? Is there going to be a world war or not?
Sorry, what? What people are chatting to me?
No one is talking to you, but I guess people inside. Maybe some of the bar staff afterwards, we can have a little chat with them. Anyway, Charlie Skelton, thanks very much for your time and your insight, and God bless all of you looking after the rest of us, actually doing a proper journalistic job by scrutinising this lot. Thanks ever so much for joining us, Charlie.
Good to speak to you, Tony.
So that's Charlie Skelton speaking to me live from Madrid, and a very nice place it sounds like he is in there, about the Bilderberg meeting, the Bilderberg conference. I think the obvious thing to do after that, it's very difficult to follow, is to read this week's poem from our resident poet Patricia Opulenza, and it's called A Demon's Den. Bilderberg, a dodgy crew of billionaires who all wish to do destruction to the world we know by staging wars, pretending, though, it's not their fault that bombs that kill may initiate a nuclear spill. Blame Russia, China, the Middle East, yet the people there just want peace. Ukraine war hidden, the West is fighting, laced with lies each day igniting. Short fuses daily with puff piece news, behind the scenes the owner's views. The West at war with Russia hides, while Gaza their target for genocide. EU, NATO, IMF, UN, world leaders picked from a demon's den. Bilderberg, where the names they choose all compromised. Vile secrets, schmooze. To do the bidding of billionaires, their faces hidden in devil's lair. EC, CB, EG, jobs ranked, each puppeteer ne'er outranked, awarded to the compromise, the dodgy few before our eyes, who sold their souls, the devil's crew, to do their worst, each promise true, cheating, scheming, and hidden stealth, destruction hides behind great wealth. Each year they meet, now secrets out, the world is wiser to all those snouts, vile men and women with ugly views who lie and cheat, yet all promise to save the world and humanity, while behind the scenes they plot to see how much power and wealth can buy. One life each holds, but clear they try to live forever with evil plans, or take us with them if they can. So jealous of the life they see, now they are old, not long to see the world they could have helped make good, instead chose evil and a vile thirst for blood. Thank you very much, Patricia. We'll just have a quick break, and then we'll be back after that. And thanks ever so much, particularly to Charlie there. So that's Lulu from, I think it's, well, early 70s, A Man with a Golden Gun. Ian Fleming, the author of the book, and Ian Fleming also the fascinating person written about by John Ainsworth Davis under the pen name Christopher Crichton in that book Op JB. If you haven't read it, read it. Read it, folks. It's not an option. You really do have to read it. It's a terrific, quite an easy to read book, but it's absolutely riveting. The Last Great Secret of the Second World War. Welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Let's plunge in straight onto this topic, Martin, brought up in several ways, which is we seem to now, and the Bilderbergers will probably be drinking to this, celebrating the move from this being a tactical war between the Donbass and Ukraine into a strategic war between NATO and Russia.
Yeah, it never needed to take place. It was quite possible that the Ukrainians could have settled their differences quite amicably. And it's the reason why the war's dragged on is because the Western powers want to destabilize Russia. And they see Ukraine as a means to that end.
And they're always, basically, they seem to be making it deliberate, an attempt. So the idea was that Ukraine was always going to be the fuse that lit a much bigger conflict. The question, though, is, as Duncan Campbell was saying, you've got these aircraft flying around Kaliningrad. It's all there for people to see, and it's all visible. If this was really, the military were really going to threaten the Russians, they wouldn't have it visible on these civilian internet programs, would they?
Well, I mean, you have to think to yourself, what actual military options does NATO have here? And the reality is, if you read Marchyanov's blog, it's called Reminiscences of the Future. He's a former Russian naval officer. They haven't actually got any options short of nuclear war. The Russians have beaten them. They've learned a lot through the process of beating them. And, NATO simply hasn't got the means to attack Russia. So all of this stuff is actually chest-beating to no purpose.
Well, earlier this week, I spoke to the former US Army Psychological Warfare Officer, Scott Bennett, and I put it to him, this point we heard last week from the Andrew Bridget interview about we are actually at war with Russia, and our treacherous collaborationist political leaders have sneaked us into that. Starmer, it can't really be told said to have done that, but of course he would have been briefed, but mainly Sunak and Cameron and the King have sneaked us into this war, but they just haven't told us yet.
Our British MP Andrew Bridgen, who's just about he expires as an MP tomorrow, from the Conservative Party, he's been talking to Andrei Kellin, who's the Russian ambassador to London, and he's convinced that Britain is already at war with Russia and that they just haven't told the people yet.
Yes, I agree with that 100%, and that's why they're afraid. They're afraid that if the people find out they're already at war, they will hang by the neck until dead, these British parliamentarians who have put them in that position. And the same applies to the United States and all these other countries that have never voted for war against Russia and have never, in fact, voted and been behind the provision of weapons and money to Ukraine. This has been the great manipulation and the great lie and the deception from these government bureaucrat elitists, whether it's Boris Johnson or Liz Truss or Rishi Sunak or Joe Biden or Macron or Olaf Scholz or Annalena Baerbock. They are all representing themselves. They are all being independently enriched, and the people of their countries are the ones who are suffering. So they have to create a war very quickly to try and create the circumstances that would put the people in their country into more of an obedient posture, that their people would submit to the war agenda that they've been trying to cultivate. So
well, you've worked in psychological operations. What is the role of the mass media? Because we're seeing massive differences in different parts of the world as to what is people are being told on their television screens, in their radio, and in the newspapers, Scott.
Well, the media has totally transformed over the last 10, 20 years into more of a government stenographer, a government reporting system. It is not independent scholars or researchers digging into issues or events or people or phenomenon in order to arrive at an interesting, truthful, revelatory position on a subject. That those days are gone. I think they've been gone since the 1970s. What we have instead is a stunted class of bloated, bureaucratic-minded regurgitators that simply regurgitate the strategic communications pamphlets and talking points and reports that come out of the CIA, MI6, MI5, the various intelligence agencies in the EU, NATO, American Alliance, the Five Eye Alliance. That's what the media has transformed into. That's why many have left the mainstream media, including people like Tucker Carlson, Judge Napolitano, Redacted, on and on and on. Many independent voices have left the mainstream media because they've been persecuted or they've been fired. So it's because the mainstream media has adopted a position of subservience to government and government money and the money behind the government people that they've abandoned all of their independence and integrity.
So that's former US Army Psychological Warfare Officer Scott Bennett there. Martin, what do you make of his points about the press there, regurgitators?
Well, I think it's true that they do that. I don't necessarily think that there was a golden age where they didn't.
Well, what about Duncan Campbell? We've just had him on. I mean, he was someone who was an investigative journalist in the 1980s. We don't have anything like that now. We had Roger Cook a few weeks ago doing it. You know, there has been an enormous change. I don't think there's any doubt about that. The people who are actually looking into things aren't there anymore. People who are observers who will write down what they're expected to write down and ignore what they're expected to ignore, well, they're all over the place, and particularly loads of these media studies graduates straight out of college.
Well, I think that's right. And I think even in the past, these voices were marginal. We know who Duncan Campbell is. And,
well, everybody knew. Back in the 1980s, my point is everybody knew. Everybody knew who he was, Martin. Everyone was watching the television and he was there. We had World in Action, Panorama. We had a whole series of First Tuesday, masses of them. It was normal. In fact, the broadcasters had to broadcast this investigative stuff. Anyway, I don't want to have some massive row with you. Things have massively changed. I don't think there's any doubt about that. It's nice to hear Scott at least confirming what he thinks what I'm saying. A lot of it is to do with ownership of the press. The actual different cross-media owners, there's far less diversity in ownership of the press, but there's also no regulation. In fact, Ofcom, who are the broadcast regulators for the UK, actually were at Bilderberg a couple of years ago. So they're on the team. They're on the same side. Couple of other stories this week, though, Martin, we must cover before we finish, is the one about Boris Johnson bringing in the Ukrainian neo-Nazi unit, the Azov Battalion, into Parliament. Mainstream media, the Canary says, are ignoring it. Johnson welcomed the Azov Brigade into as heroes. Now, what on earth is Boris Johnson even doing it, welcoming anybody to Parliament? He's not an MP anymore.
No, but he's still there in the background, isn't he? I think I sent you the email of this, didn't I? He's there waving a Wolfsnagel flag with the Azov Battalion, set up by Paribi, I believe, who's one of the far-right leaders in the Ukraine. They're like the Ulster Volunteer Force, but they've been integrated into the Ukrainian army as separate units with a you know, neo-Nazi ideology. And there is Boris Johnson welcoming them to Parliament.
As heroes. The neo-Nazi militia.
He's played a particularly pernicious role in stopping peace in the Ukraine.
He has made sure it didn't happen. In fact,
he relished the whole thing of saying, no, he relished his Churchill moment.
Yeah, well, it wasn't a Churchill moment, even.
No,
it wasn't
a Churchill moment. In his mind.
I mean, he's
Never heard a shot fired in anger. Maybe he should. Margaret Thatcher had a shot fired in anger at Brighton, didn't she? Not for Boris.
The neo-Nazi Azov militia was founded in 2014 by white supremacist Andrei Bieliecki, who designed its logo with symbols once used by the SS. It was eventually integrated into the Ukrainian armed forces while retaining Third Reich iconography. The battalion has been accused by Human Rights Watch, Amnesty and the UN, multiple human rights abuses, including rape and torture of civilians. Well, I've also seen them shooting prisoners as well. I don't know if people have seen those videos from the early stages of the Ukraine war. So Azov Nazis being cheered in Parliament. This is rather like the Nazis being cheered in Canada, isn't it? It's almost like, well, actually, we don't really care about the Nazis anymore, even though we have lots of films on about the Holocaust and that sort of thing. The Nazis, well they were kind of okay.
Well, obviously, what happened with the guy in the Canadian Parliament is that was a big public space and it all went round the world, and eventually it was exposed, as we know, by Warren Thornton in Western. But this event was very much less high profile than that. But of course, Boris Johnson is basically polishing his credentials as a super pro war with Russia person. You know, and he said you can read about it in the Daily Mail, and this is where he's pushing this line. He's contemptible. What he has done in relation to the Ukraine war is an insult to Britain's war dead in two world wars. And it's from somebody who's never served in the armed forces, would never have been accepted into the armed forces, is clearly unfit, and is basically a warmonger and a coward. It's unbelievable.
Also, finally, revealed an Israeli spy chief threatened the International Criminal Court prosecutor over the war crimes inquiry. Mossad director Yossi Cohen personally involved in a secret plot to pressure Fatton Bensouda to drop Palestine investigation, sources are saying. The former head of the Mossad, Israel's foreign intelligence agency, threatened a chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court in a series of secret meetings. He tried to pressure her into abandoning war crimes investigation, The Guardian reveals. Covert contacts with the ICC's then prosecutor took place in the years leading up to her decision to open a formal investigation into war crimes, which have now come to them requesting arrest warrants. So the Israelis are, I think, actually even after the announcement last week, there have been more threats from Israel against the International Criminal Court. So it's as if they believe they are totally above the law. They're not interested in obeying the law. What's going on?
Well, I mean, you've just summed it up in a nutshell. They think they're above the law. They're not interested in obeying the law. And just like all mafiosi, they threaten law enforcement. You know, we know where you live and all the rest of it. John Bolton, famously, you know, Trump's advisor, when the International Criminal Court was thinking of looking into both US and Israeli war crimes, he said what they've got to remember, these lawyers in the Netherlands, is that we know where their children live. Not just we know where you live, we know where your children live. And there's, you know, there's been a number of congressmen in the US, Republican congressmen, have already put down an early day motion that they will, you know, they're going to go after these lawyers if they dare to do anything against their beloved Israel. But of course, the rest of the world can see all of this now. World War III is going to be about the establishment of international law, as World War II was, and we are the baddies. We are the baddies.
Well, certainly the Americans seem to be. Maybe the Brits are a little tiny, weeny bit independent. Who knows? I think the King is most definitely involved in all of this, and so will be Keir Starmer, Martin. I worry about his ability to do anything that's not written on a script for him, and he's certainly very able to change his views overnight, it seems, with things like this. Maybe we'll just finish on this issue with Diane Abbott. It's just horrific what they've done. Obviously, there were factions within the National Executive, the Labour Party, that wanted to make sure she's not around, and Diane herself making publicity around "Yes, I am going to stand." Has kind of forced the issue, but it's awful that she should have had to really make a public demonstration and a battle outside the Hackney Town Hall in order to be accepted as a Labour MP. But well done to Diane, and all the very best to her. Time to sign off now. Thanks very much to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, also to Wesley Bear, and to, of course, to Charlie Skelton joining us live, as well as Duncan Campbell, who is not joining us live. Thanks also to sound engineer Dave Bazanko, who managed to carry all those little live links and stuff off very well. And you can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Share stuff there, please. Do send me interviews and story tips also via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll also find the podcast, the full-length interviews, story links, the comment page, and our email addresses. You can also subscribe to my weekly newsletter there, and even donate at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I will mention my book about the Bilderbergers. It's what's it called? The Traitors of Arnhem, that's right. Martin Bormann and the Bilderberg Group Origins. That's available from bilderberg.org. And we've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey. Also adding this week, DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, streaming us live, and also on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast us a show, just shove it under some internet radio station's nose, and that would be lovely. We can credit them here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday at 5. God bless. And don't let the Bilderberg World War III more mongerers get you down.
There must be some kind of way out. Say the Joker to the thief. There's too much confusion. I can't get no relief. Businessman there, to drink my wine. Plowman, dig my earth.
from Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you. I've traveled the world to learn I must return from Russia with love. I've seen places, faces, and smiled for a moment, but oh, you haunted me so. Still my tongue tied, young pride would not let my love for you show. In case you'd say no, to Russia I flew, but there a man I suddenly knew you'd care again. Fly to you from Russia with love.
The dictator of Tomania, the conqueror of Austerlitz, the future emperor of the world. You must speak.
I can't.
You must. It's our only hope.
I'm sorry, but I don't want to be an emperor. That's not my business. I don't want to rule or conquer anyone. I should like to help everyone if possible. Jew, Gentile, black man, white. We all want to help one another. Human beings are like that. We want to live by each other's happiness, not by each other's misery. We don't want to hate and despise one another. In this world, there's room for everyone, and the good earth is rich and can provide for everyone. The way of life can be free and beautiful, but we have lost the way. Greed has poisoned men's souls, has barricaded the world with hate, has goose-stepped us into misery and bloodshed. We have developed speed, but we have shut ourselves in. Machinery that gives abundance has left us in want. Our knowledge has made us cynical, our cleverness hard and unkind. We think too much and feel too little. More than machinery, we need humanity. More than cleverness, we need kindness and gentleness. Without these qualities, life will be violent and all will be lost. The aeroplane and the radio have brought us closer together. The very nature of these inventions cries out for the goodness in men, cries out for universal brotherhood, for the unity of us all. Even now, my voice is reaching millions throughout the world. Millions of despairing men, women, and little children, victims of a system that makes men torture and imprison innocent people. To those who can hear me, I say, do not despair. The misery that is now upon us is but the passing of greed, the bitterness of men who fear the way of human progress. The hate of men will pass, and dictators die, and the power they took from the people will return to the people. And so long as men die, liberty will never perish. Soldiers, don't give yourselves to brutes, men who despise you, enslave you, who regiment your lives, tell you what to do, what to think, and what to feel, who drill you, diet you, treat you like cattle, use you as cannon fodder. Don't give yourselves to these unnatural men with machine minds and machine hearts. You are not machines. You are not cattle. You are men. You have the love of humanity in your hearts. You don't hate, only the unloved hate, the unloved and the unnatural. Soldiers, don't fight for slavery, fight for liberty. In the 17th chapter of St. Luke it is written, the kingdom of God is within man, not one man nor a group of men, but in all men, in you. You, the people, have the power to create machines, the power to create happiness. You, the people, have the power to make this life free and beautiful, to make this life a wonderful adventure. Then in the name of democracy, let us use that power. Let us all unite. Let us fight for a new world, a decent world. That will give men a chance to work, that will give youth a future and old age a security. By the promise of these things, brutes have risen to power. But they lie. They do not fulfill that promise. They never will. Dictators free themselves, but they enslave the people. Now let us fight to fulfill that promise. Let us fight to free the world, to do away with national barriers, to do away with greed, with hate and intolerance. Let us fight for a world of reason. A world where science and progress will lead to all men's happiness. Soldiers, in the name of democracy, let us all unite!
Stranger, 'cause I heard his sweet song, and it was gently enticing me, though there was something wrong. But when I turned, he was gone, blinding me. His song remains reminding me he's a bandit and a heartbreaker. Oh, but Jesus was a cross maker. Sweet silver angels over the sea, please come down, fly and low for me. He wages war with the devil, a pistol by his side, though he chases him out windows and won't give him a place to hide. He keeps his door open wide, fighting him, he lights a lamp in. I hear the thunder come rumbling, the light never looks so dim. I see the junction get nearer, and danger is in the wind, and either rose looking grim. I'm a hiding me, a fleet desire dividing me. He's a bandit and a heartbreaker. Oh, but Jesus was a cross maker. Crossmaker, sweet silver angels over the sea, please come down, fly and low for me. One time I trusted a stranger, 'cause I heard his sweet song, and it was gently enticing me, though there was something wrong. But when I turned, he was